7th Committee on Rules. Representative Nelson, I see that you're here, but I've got to get Mr. Crane in and out of here to get him to Portland. Why don't you come on up? We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1037. Senator Ringo, do you want to tell us what we got, briefly?
Madam Chair, we have the Dash 18 amendments. These are very similar to the amendments that we discussed in this committee, and we adopted about three of those amendments about 2 weeks ago. And the intent of this bill is really to do only about three things. One is to clarify the claims process. Two is to clarify the judicial review process. And three is to allow track to record. The point of the bill is to clarify some of the technicalities on filing Measure 37 claims to make it easier both for governments at the state and local level, and also for claimants, so that they know that when they're filing a claim, they know what they're dealing with. It does not clarify the big questions. It does not clarify transferability, for example. It does not reference a compensation mechanism. It does not take away any Measure 37 claims, for example. So it doesn't do a lot of things, but I think it's intended to be a rather modest approach to help governments and claimants address Measure 37 issues.
Senator Ringo, did you say 17 or dash 18?
Dash 18s.
Okay. Mr. Crane, and I'm sorry, I'm a phonetic speller, so every time I see your name in my brain, I want to say Crane. So take it away.
Thank you, Chair Brown, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Chris Crane. I've been working on this with Sneezy, Grumpy, Sleepy, and everybody else for about 6 months now. My first testimony is, if you give us another week, we'll find more problems to fix. Please move this bill. The first change from what you saw last week, you'll find in the Dash 18s on page 8. The bill sets up a system of claims under Measure 37. Claims filed after a certain date, March 16th, would be under these new provisions. And in our definition of waive, there at the top of page 8, this is section 2, sub 11, we modified the language of A and B to reflect what's in the current Measure 7 so that it would allow a waiver to allow the property to be used, to allow the owner to use the property for use permit at the time the owner acquired the property. That's the existing language in Measure 37. That's the language the Attorney General hung his hat on when he said that the claim is not, waiver is not transferable. And so we wanted to make sure that that waiver language was the same whether the claim is prospective or retroactive. On page 18, this is section 7, under the section on judicial review, what we looked at last week, this is, I'm addressing now subsection 2, beginning on line 11. It says that a person who is adversely affected by a final decision on a Measure 37 claim may seek judicial review of the decision by filing a petition in circuit court. It used to say a person who is adversely affected and who was entitled to notice of the decision in another part of the bill. We took out that two-part test for standing, just left it at the existing judicial standards for judicial review. And if, for those of you who are interested, the Dash 18s include the track of record provision, and that is found in section 11, and that is pretty much unchanged from last week.
And that's on page 22?
That's correct.
And Mr. Crane, for the record, this section 11 is not intended in any way to subvert or destroy a ballot Measure 37 claim. Is that correct?
That's correct, Senator Brown.
All right. Other questions for Mr. Crane? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anybody else wishing to testify on the Dash 18 amendments to Senate Bill 1037? We're in work session.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash A18 amendments to Senate Bill 1037.
Senator Ringo has moved the Dash A18 amendments to Senate Bill 1037. Any discussion? Any objection? Senator Atkinson be recorded as a no. Motion carries. Senator Ringo.
Madam Chair, I move the Senate Bill 1037 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Ringo has moved Senate Bill 1037 as amended with the Dash A18 amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Please call the roll.
Senator Atkinson?
No.
Senator Ringo?
Aye.
Senator Keel?
Yes.
Vice Chair Ferrioli? Chair Brown?
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. Senator Ringo, we're going to let you carry this little baby onto the Senate floor.
I'm surprised.
No, they're not. Okay, Representative Nelson, are you here on House Bill 2932? All right, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2932. Come on forward. Do we know when Senator Wesson can be available?
Am I supposed to remember to get you?
No, she can't. Go ahead. We're on House Bill 2932. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2932.
Okay, thank you, Chair Brown, Senator Ringo, and Senator Shields, and wherever Senator Atkinson went, and Administrator Tiffany, thank you very much for allowing me to be here today on behalf of 370,000 veterans in this state, and their families, our surviving spouses and relatives, and for our future veterans and our current military and their families. I will thank you in advance for passing this bill to establish the Department of Veteran Affairs, as should have been done formally many, many years ago, but was not. Instead, all the responsibility for assisting these men and women who offered to give their lives for you and me was left to one individual in statute, the director. So basically, House Bill 2933 establishes formally the Department of Veteran Affairs, who will assist these individuals with their many, many needs. And we are so grateful for their services as well as those who risk their lives for us.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Questions for Representative Nelson? Senator Shields.
Silly question. Why didn't we do this a million years ago?
Senator Shields, I wasn't here a million years ago, but if I had been, I'd have had it done. I don't know, sir, but thanks to a brilliant lawyer in our council office, here we are. Even the good director, current director, did not realize this, but because of the fiduciary responsibility, it's very important that we put in statute.
Okay. Thank you. Anything else? We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2932. Senator Starr, I assume you're here on SJR 34. Is that correct? We're going to open a public hearing on SJR 34. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the measure? And Senator Starr, come on forward.
SJR
34?
34. I'm sorry. That's okay. SJR 34. I'm sure we're doing SJR 34.
It's
24. 24. I'm sorry. In my brain, it was 34.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. SJR 24 directs the Port of Portland to rename the Portland International Airport Victor D. Atiyah Portland International Airport. And we do have a couple of amendments.
That's correct. Hello. Senator Starr.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, Chairwoman. Members of the committee, thank you. For the record, I'm State Senator Bruce Starr from District 15, representing Western Washington County. I appreciate the opportunity to testify, and I appreciate the public hearing on SJR 24. I am the responsible party for the Dash 1 amendments. I haven't seen any other amendments. But the Dash 1 amendments changed the focus of the bill. Instead of having the Port of Portland rename the airport for Governor Atiyah, it directs the Port of Portland to name the international terminal or a terminal at the airport for Governor Atiyah. I think that that's an appropriate response to Governor Atiyah's record of accomplishments in public service in Oregon. I look back at my short stint of service here in the Oregon legislature, having served through what I think is one could say is probably the most difficult economic times that this state has faced since the early 80s when Governor Atiyah was the governor here. And Governor Atiyah, under his leadership, really led the state not only through that recession, but really built and established the economic development platform from which I think much of the decade of the late 80s and the 90s and our economic boom was created. I provided to you a copy of an article that was printed in the Business Journal on July 22, 1985, that outlines the history and the background related to the repeal of the unitary tax. It's a very informative and interesting article. I encourage you to take a look at that. I'm not going to necessarily go into all of that, but it really underlines the kind of leadership that Governor Attia brought to the governor's office, calling a special session of the legislature to get the unitary tax repealed, and the kinds of economic activity that attracted to our state really built the foundation for what's now become the Silicon Forest in western Washington County and other places in our state. Governor Attia put Oregon on the map internationally, having gone on several trade missions overseas while he was governor. He really did open Oregon to the rest of the world. I think that this small token of appreciation or recognition of Governor Attia's impact and influence in Oregon, I think it's well deserved, and I'd urge a due pass on that, on at least the adoption of the Dash ones. I haven't seen the other amendments, but I think that honoring Governor Attia in this way, I think, is something that this legislature can do, and I'd urge your support. I appreciate Senator Metzger's co-sponsorship of this. Senator Metzger's here.
Thank you. Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26. And just to briefly echo my colleagues' comments on Governor Attia's and his contributions to international trade and developing industry in Oregon. The phrase, think globally, act locally, I think was embraced by Governor Attia long before it became a catchphrase. I know some of the material that Senator Starr has handed out goes into those details, but I think it's fair to say that Governor Attia's vision in the early 80s, and when Senator Starr was talking about the unitary tax and what that might mean and to growing the international trade in this state, I mean, almost single-handedly within a matter of years made a difference for Fujitsu and Sony. Locker Siltronic has had a number of expansions since then, and I know the current governor is now working with them on others, but never would have been here at all if it wasn't for Governor Attia's leadership in this area. And his recognition, I think, with the international wing of Portland International Airport, as he also strived long, hard, and successfully to expand service to other countries to bring those kinds of services and that type of economic growth to Oregon is well established and would certainly be well recognized and would appreciate your positive consideration.
I might add, Madam Chair, I've vetted these amendments with the port folks, Bill Wyatt and others there, so they're supportive.
Thank you. Questions for Senator Starr or Senator Metzger? Your SJR has developed a little caboose. The amendments aren't here yet, but I think you'll be okay with the caboose. So.
Well, I appreciate the public hearing. Look forward to seeing the measure on the Senate floor.
We hope.
Madam Chair?
Senator Ringo.
I just point out that Governor Attia, in his vision and leadership, proposed and implemented a tax increase to deal with our fiscal issues, and we might think about his wisdom today.
Well, I would just remind the senator from Beaverton that's what the legislature did last time, and the folks spoke pretty loudly and clearly on that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right.
That's so noted. Thank you very much.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate your willingness to come forward on such short notice. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on SJR 24. I'm sorry, I had 34 in my brain. Commissioner Witte was here. She's not here. You're just here to watch. Representative Greenlick. Okay. Let's go back up to work session on House Bill 2480. Ms. Harris, why don't you remind us what the bill does and whether we have any amendments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We heard House Bill 2480 a couple of weeks ago. It prohibits the Department of Human Services from limiting prescription drugs used to treat hepatitis C. Current statute contains a similar prohibition with respect to drugs used to treat mental illness, cancer, and HIV/AIDS. That's about it.
Thank you. I have the Dash 1 amendments in my file. I think it's just emergency clause.
Right. Right. There was a Dash 1 amendment that we considered during the public hearing. I'm not aware of any additional amendments.
Okay. All right. Senator Ringo.
I was going to ask if the Dash 1 amendments are from Representative Greenlick, or I don't think so.
No, because okay. He's here on 2706.
Okay.
Is anybody here on the Dash 1 amendments? No. Okay. All right, we're getting strong signals that they're not wanted. I'm going to just caution everyone on this committee. The chair heard the testimony, feels pretty strongly about the content of the measure. We also received a letter from the governor's office expressing concern about the bill. I just think this is a policy question over which reasonable people can disagree, and so just want to put that so everyone's aware. So the chair would move House Bill 2480 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Senator Atkinson?
Yes.
Senator Greenbill?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ferriero?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Motion passes. I'm going to let Senator Bates carry that bill. Let's go into work session on House Bill 2706. Ms. Harris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2706 combines the informed consent requirements that are in place for routine prenatal examinations with the informed consent requirements in place with respect to testing for HIV.
Folks have any questions about the bill? Representative Greenlick was here, and there are no amendments, correct?
Correct.
Chair would move the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing, seeing none. So ordered. I'm going to let Senator Montes Anderson carry this bill. Thank you. Okay. Senator Przanski around. All right.
Senator Brown, are you waiting for Senator Brown?
Yes.
May I request unanimous consent to register my vote on Senate Bill 1037?
That's the purpose of a minority.
It is not.
No.
Oh, okay.
Senator Ferrioli has asked for unanimous consent to vote on Senate Bill 1037. It will not change the outcome. Senator Ringo?
I would only object if I thought it was going to lead to a minority report.
It's not.
And so I'm accepting his statement that it won't.
All right. Thank you. So there are no objections so long as the vote does not lead to a minority report. Any further discussion? Consent was granted. Senator Ferrioli, how do you wish to vote on Senate Bill 1037? Yeah, well, we wouldn't let you.
Not.
Thank you.
I vote no.
Okay. Senator Ferrioli votes no on Senate Bill 1037. It will not change the outcome. Thank you very much. So open a work session on Senate Bill 1074. Senator Przanski, why don't you come forward?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Regarding the amendments that are before you, I believe they are number -5. And what this will do is basically set a cap of 10% of the general fund. This is based on conversations I've had with members of this committee regarding what would be, comfortable to try to meet some of the additional needs the city brought forward, and at the same time taking care of the issue that has already been discussed.
Okay, you mean the -6 amendments?
-6
of amendments?
Yes, I apologize. I don't
have
that. Okay,
thank you. Does the city of Cobourg have any additional amendments they wish us to consider? Which number is it?
You could read the proposed amendments to Senate Bill 1074. Doesn't have a dash number.
-4 amendments.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
It does do. -4.
Okay.
And since this is written, we haven't made an additional.
I need your name for the record, sir. I'm sorry. You're okay.
I'm Bill Judd, City Council for Cobourg, Oregon. And on page 3, we made an addition to the amendment. On line 22, it shows during the 12-month period may not exceed, it read 10% of the city's annual budget, and we have changed that to read 5%. of the city's annual budget.
Oh, I see they're attached. Okay, I'm sorry, I didn't realize your amendments were attached. We have the dash fours, five, and six in front of us. The dash sixes are Senator Prezanski's. The dash fours are the city of Coburg's, is my understanding.
Correct.
Yes, as conceptually amended.
And
Senator Prezanski, do you wish to respond to the dash four amendments?
The dash four, what it basically does, it sets it up on the annual fund of the city. Mm-hmm. What the annual fund of the city currently is approximately $6 million. So 5% would be $300,000, and that's pretty much where their status quo is right now as to what they're wanting to bring in is $360,000 to make the budget. I would oppose the dash fours because it does not deal with the real, the issue that's before you, and also how cities that are basing their revenue sources on traffic fines and citations is based on the general fund budget. The general fund budget is approximately $1.2 million, so that would mean that they would be capped at $120,000 currently. For those who may want a refresher, the reality is that this community, less than 1,000 people, have been bringing in close to $750,000 a year on this number. It was 48% of their budget. And we attempted to send a message back in 2003, and I would submit to you, based on their conduct, that the dash four should not be accepted and the dash six should be moved.
All right. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Can I make a statement here?
Sure.
Just to answer what Senator Prozanski has commented on, there was a message sent in 2003, we believe, and as we've stated numerous times to the committee and the senators, that was an old day. We are in a new day, new situation. We did get the message at that time. We found a problem. We feel that we have fixed the problem, not completely fixed it, but we are on the way fixing the problem. We just ask for your indulgence. We know that we've made a huge step forward. The fines and bails do not all go to running just the police department. Basically, what we're trying to do is keep the community and our end of the county safe from criminals and people breaking the law on I-5.
Thank you, Mr. Judd. We really appreciate all the time and energy that you've spent.
Well, thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. We're in work session. The chair would move the dash six amendments to Senate Bill 1074. Are you Representative Barnhart? You wish to testify? Come on out. Please understand, we've probably heard this bill more than any other bill this session. It's true.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Phil Barnhart, State Representative, House District 11, Central and Linn Counties, including the city of Coburg. I don't want to belabor the point because I know you've heard a great deal about this situation already, except to note that the committee needs to be aware that there has been a significant change in the administration of the city in the last 2 years, the current administration are people with great experience and a lot of professionalism in terms of dealing with city budgets. And one final point, the effects of this bill could be much more general than simply on the city administration, because the city does provide services to residents of the city, and also services businesses that provide over 3,000 jobs in Lane County. And so it's important that we make sure that the city government is sound and is fiscally is able to operate its city services, not only for the resident, for the value of the residents of the city of Cobourg, but also for those residents of Eugene, Creswell, Springfield, and other cities where the people live who actually commute to work in the city of Cobourg. And thank you, Madam Chair, for your indulgence for me to speak on this bill.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Senator Shields.
Yeah, Representative Barnhart, I had been going along with this line of thinking, the new administration and so on, until I had a chance encounter with a young person who was given a ticket in 2004 after the new regime and ended up in a room full of folks in court, all of whom were picked up on I-5 and not other places. And I was struck that, you know, I hear that there's a new regime, but in this person's experience, the new regime felt an awful lot like the other regime.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to give you a chance to comment on that or clarify, because it really disturbed me what I heard from an actual account of a person who'd received a ticket in the I-5 section. In fact, he received it and wasn't actually written up till several miles later as they followed him down the highway. Do you have some comments on that?
Yeah. Yes, and thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Shields. I think I'm familiar with the young person that you're referring to, and I did have an opportunity to talk with him about the incident that you described. It is my understanding that the ticket that you're talking about was received after the time that the city obtained jurisdiction over a piece of the freeway because of annexation. And that was the reason why that ticket was, and along with others, were referred to the municipal court rather than the justice court, which, as I understand it, that was the practice after the adoption of the legislation that we adopted in the last session. Other than to indicate that it's perfectly reasonable for a police officer to note an offense, a violation in one place and write a ticket in another, which happens routinely, I don't have any other comment.
Senator Shields.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure we're referring to the same situation. Circumstances were somewhat different than described, but I guess my point that I'm trying to make is this: there's a new regime, you know, and I didn't feel like having a conversation with this person, because it really felt like a new regime. I don't know how to excuse me, Madam Chair, I won't say anymore.
Okay, thank you. Representative Barnhart, do you wish to respond? If you don't, it's okay.
The only thing I can say is that difficulties that this city has had seem to be related to a particular employee who had a large number of hats during a several-year period, and those have to been redistributed to people who are very professional and were not connected with the city at the time that the original issue arose and at the time that the bill was passed during the last session. And I understand the issue that Senator Shields is raising, but without knowing more about this particular situation, I can't really comment on it.
Senator Farrielly.
Madam Chair, thank you. I think the difficulty here is that somebody in the city in the previous regime discovered that operating a speed trap can be extremely lucrative. And that allowed the city to grow its superstructure to an unsustainable level of services. The question that's come before this committee, with the indulgence of the chair, about 11 times now, is should the city be allowed to continue to operate the speed trap, or should it come into at least the norms of the other cities of its size, around 8 to 9, even up to 10%? But should it be able to continue to operate through the next period, 12 months or so, at the same rate in order to give the city a soft landing? But that was the message that was sent in 2003, and it had utterly no effect. You know, so the warning that was sent in 2003, I'm sorry, but this is an analogous for to a person who's a repeat offender and who's now gotten a speeding ticket for collecting too much money, and they really don't like the fine. And so, you know, the bottom line for me is that I've watched Senator Prozanski work. I've listened to the city. I'm sorry that there's going to be a negative effect on the community services, but the lesson here is don't rely on operating an I-5 speed trap to fund your city services. Because there's a day when people just say, you squeeze this lemon just a little too hard. And that's what we've been hearing from citizens.
Madam Chair, Senator Farioli, I agree that we should not condone the operation of the speed trap. Absolutely.
All right. Any other questions for Representative Barnhart? Thank you very much.
Thank
Great
you, Madam
to
Chair.
See you. We're in work session. The Chair would move the -6 amendments to Senate Bill 1074. Any discussion?
Just that I'm conflicted, very conflicted.
Thank you, Senator Shields.
Madam Chair.
Are you conflicted too, Senator Ingram?
No, I'm just wondering when they're going to get Senator Atkinson going back and forth from Salem to Jacksonville, right through Coburn.
On that bicycle.
On that bicycle. Okay. Any further discussion on the -6 amendments? All right. Seeing any objection to the -6 amendments? Seeing none, so ordered. The Chair would move a bill as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Prozanski, you will carry, please. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Thank you. Mm-hmm, that's what they all say. House Bill 3174. All right. We're going to go down to public hearing on House Bill 3174. Representative Dallum, why don't you come forward? Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill?
Thanks, Madam Chair and Committee. House Bill 3174A establishes processes and criteria for the renewal of public school charters.
All right. Representative Dallum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm John Dallum, Representative, House District 59, and I want to talk to you about House Bill 3174.
Okay. Just so you know, there are -5 amendments, which I believe are not done yet. I believe they're technical in nature, but I don't know that for sure. So we haven't seen them yet, so we won't move the bill until we see those amendments.
I have not seen the -5 amendments, but I've heard about them. Let me tell you about the problem with the charter school bill was that it did not have a procedure for charter school renewal. And with the growth and development of charter schools, we're now to a point where a renewal process with definite criteria is necessary. This bill came to the House Education Committee, was sent to subcommittee. The State Board of Ed and ODE were represented by Randy Harnish. The OEA was represented, OSBA, and the Charter School Development Center and myself met, all concurred with the provisions of the bill as written. It established a procedure, and House Bill 3175 is that procedure. We came out of committee with unanimous consensus out of the subcommittee. We came out of the House Education Committee with unanimous agreement. We came off the House floor with 48-8-3-2. And so I think that we can say that this bill has bipartisan support, and I would ask that you move to the Senate floor with House Bill 3174.
Thank you, Representative Allen. Questions? Thank you. I see Mr. Green and Ms. Hikes are here. I would ask that the three of you step out, review the amendments, make sure they're okay. Okay? Thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3174. Yes. Senator Starr. Okay. Do we have a technical, a conflict amendment on 3092? Okay. Hans just gave us correct. Let's wait until Charlie's back. Sarah Starr, what bill are you here on?
Well, it's the one you just closed the hearing on.
Well, I'll open the hearing back up, but there are -5 amendments, and I want everyone to take a look at them, so come on up.
Well, I haven't seen those amendments, Madam Chair.
I'm State Senator Charles Starr, representing Senate District 13, and I'm here in support of House Bill 3174. And I would be delighted to get a chance to look at those Dash 5 amendments, but this bill is very important, as we have now had charter schools in Oregon for some 5 years, and we need a plan for reconstituting, reissuing their charters, extending those charters, and I believe that the efforts that have been made, the work that's been done, has been fruitful, and I'm hopeful that we'll see this bill passed on to the Senate floor and approved there so that we might continue what has been a great experiment in our state.
Great.
Thank you.
Any questions for Senator Starr?
Ms. Hykus, Mr. Green, do you guys want to come on up and finish off the public hearing since everybody's okayed the amendments? Yeah, these guys will. Thank you, Senator Starr. We appreciate you joining us this afternoon.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Karen Hykus, and this is the first time I have testified before you, so I appreciate the opportunity to do so. I am the director of the Oregon Charter Schools Development Center, which is new as a statewide charter school organization as of January 2005 in Oregon. We work with charter school developers, operators, and sponsors to provide technical assistance to ensure quality charter schools. We are the group that initially drafted this bill, which did become Senate Bill 789 and House Bill 3174, and subsequently has gone through the work group process, as you've heard from Representatives Dallum and Senator Starr. The situation is that we have 57 charter schools. We've had our law for about 6 years. The law allows charters to last for anywhere from 1 to 5 years. Most charters last for 3 years. The current charter school law, ORS 338, does not really address the issue of charter school renewal. It simply states may be renewed upon authorization of the district. Does not stipulate provisions for the criteria by which that decision should be made, the timeline, the process. So this bill would provide for those areas. So the key provisions are that the performance of the charter school would be the primary criteria by which the charter school renewal decision would be made. If the charter school is performing well, abiding by all the terms of its contract, and the district's provided oversight and can determine that, then the charter school would be renewed. If the charter school is not performing, it would not be renewed. The process would tie closely to provisions that already exist in the charter school law, namely the annual report the charter school submits and the site visit by their sponsor. The timeline is the piece that does have an amendment, but essentially our goal as a work group was to ensure that the discussion about renewals begins early enough that there's time to make all those decisions so that if school gets closed and students have to move, they have time to do that. The term length is also provided for because it's really difficult for charters to rent facilities or buy facilities, and it's also very difficult for students to have to move from school to school if the charter doesn't last for very long. Mm-hmm. So that's why we wanted to provide for a term length of minimum of 5 years, maximum of 10 years, so that the charter could have longevity and the students could know they could finish, for instance, elementary or middle or high. I do understand that some of our districts have some concerns with the timelines that we built in because some of them just within their processes cannot meet those timelines, and that's what the amendment addresses. So I would support that. And also, just so you know, that the time that the charter ends is not the only time that a charter can be revoked. If a charter is not performing well, a charter can be revoked at any time. And the Charter Schools Development Center is supportive of quality charter schools, not all charter schools. So we want to make sure that at the renewal time and any other time, charters are serving students well and that they're academically sound and operationally sound.
Thank you. Mr. Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association, here in support of the bill and the Dash A5 amendments, which you've just received. What the Dash A5 amendments do to the bill is allow the sponsoring entity, a school district or the state board in some cases, and the chartering body to agree to a different timeline for the renewal process. I heard from several school districts, Portland Public, Eugene, even Paisley and Camas Valley, some of our smaller ones that have charter schools, that said, we can't meet those timelines. We have a process we've already negotiated with our other side that we'll use, and that's what we'd like to use. What this amendment does is allow that to happen. If they don't have that in the charter, the fallback are the timelines that are in the bill, and I think that'll force them to the table to discuss that, if those timelines will work or if it won't work, and that's what's included in the Dash A5s.
All right. Great questions for this panel. Thank you very much, Representative McBauer. You're just here in support of House Bill 3174.
Yes, Chairman Brown. In fact, Jim and Karen is up next to the panel. I decided in the FCC stage time I would
be. You are very smart. Okay, anybody else wishing to testify besides Representative Farr's very eloquent testimony on House Bill 3174? Close the public hearing on House Bill 3174. Open work session on House Bill 3174. Chair, remove the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 3174. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Chair would move the bill as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing seeing none. So ordered. Senator Morissette can carry this baby. Senator Farrioli. Oh, yes. So I was going to pull up House Bill 1072. Let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1072. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill? Senator Nelson, why don't you come on up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 1072 establishes a statewide policy regarding the utilization of forest biomass. And we have an amendment as well.
Okay. All right. Sarah Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Brown. My name is David Nelson, State Senator from Pendleton. I represent four counties in eastern Oregon, Marl, Umatilla, Union, and Wallowa County. And part of my reasons for being here is some concerns that have been expressed through my county. We have a little quick slideshow here for you that hopefully will give you some sense of where I'm coming from and why I'm thinking about this particular bill. You may well know that I'm believing that our system needs more money for our public services. Taxpayer said he doesn't want to pay more tax money, or he or she, we are not talking about tax reform. So the other alternative I see is somehow broaden the base of our economy. We also have some issues with forest health. So I married these two together, and so somehow or another, I'm here before you. So Jesse, beside me is Jesse Larkey, who's been my assistant in this thing and really helpful. He's what's going to Puerto Rico tomorrow.
We all wish we were going with him.
It looks like you probably were there. Okay, go ahead, Jesse.
We'll just be 1 second.
Sorry, Nelson, and let me guess, you need him to run the computer?
How did you know?
Just a guess. It's
supposed to be the technology guru.
Yeah.
Nothing about it. Well, let me just give you a little background. I mean, we've had a huge amount of interested parties involved in this, from industry to the agencies to environmental groups. And so we've had two or three workforces. I can tell you right now that probably industry is not real happy with this bill, and probably environmental groups are not real happy with this bill. And I'm sure you'll hear that testimony today. But what we did is we tried to come up with something that would address, I think, two particular needs. One is the health of the forest, and two is how do you create more jobs in the state. And so that's where we're at with that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Farrioli.
Can I make an observation?
Yes.
We've put a lot of reliance in Oregon in the high technology sector. Perhaps it's time we look at the basic sectors, because they're the ones that are reliable.
Thank you, Senator Farrioli, for your editorial comment. Any luck? Oh, there it comes.
I can't get a chainsaw to work either, so I'm having my trouble here.
We did have it working nicely before the meeting.
Okay.
Was working earlier?
Yeah.
Can you believe it? Okay. Let's
okay.
They were still.
Oh, and it's now not working. Okay. You tested it earlier, is what you're saying. Okay.
There will also be some written testimony. I think Hal Sawasher, who is the dean at Oregon State, has some written testimony. He could be here to...
There are a number of people wishing to testify.
I know. But these are some people that may not be here. I don't think anybody's here from the governor's office, but we've included them in the discussion.
You know what, Senator Nelson, do you have a copy of the...
I do. You want to just go ahead?
You want to walk us through that, unless we can get the technology to work?
Okay, get the technology going.
Okay.
It's not going to go. Okay, the first picture is a picture of some trees. That's good. Good. The second picture, public west and private east. I think this really illustrates the problems that we have. I mean, if you look at the western states, a huge amount of their land mass is owned by the federal government.
And just so you know, Senator Nelson, Congressman Rob Bishop from Utah is going to be introducing a measure in Congress on the very issue and is looking for co-sponsors and would love to have the Oregon delegation signed on and board. The bill would essentially require payments in lieu of taxes for federal lands owned in this western state. So it's a pretty interesting measure. So
okay, good. Well, the third slide I have, I'm claiming the circle of prosperity is broken, and I down in the right hand column we have the generate sufficient revenue for excellent schools. I mean, that's why we're here, is that we're having a real issue with that. So what I'm claiming is that the circle of prosperity has a lot of good concepts in it, but we need to look at it in a little bit different viewpoint. Fourth slide, forest health. That's a picture taken from the Smithsonian magazine, and I have a copy of it here if anybody would like to look at it. Basically just talking about from a national scene. I mean, this isn't a Western thing. The Smithsonian is kind of another thing. And the fifth slide is a firefight and has the, the picture of it and saying, we do have this problem. The sixth one with the woman forester there, saying if I had done all the thinning we wanted to over the years, we could have kept this fire from exploding. This is actually a fire in Arizona that she's talking about. The next one is federal forest land. Basically, I think the fact here you have to know is that 1 out of 4 acres in the state of Oregon, about 16 million acres out of the 65 million acres in the state of Oregon are federal forest land. The next slide is on the fire risk. The green portion of it is that's the historical. That means it's probably okay. The real light pink is not forest land. The ordinary purple, I guess, is the fire land that is at moderate or some type of risk. And then the dark purple is the forest land that is at heavy risk. The next slide, the tree mortality in Oregon, you can just see, where the trees, they're considering they're dying from whatever reasons. So we do have an issue. The next one, the National Forest Growth and Removal. The red line is the amount of net material we have in the forest. The blue line, which you see starting in 1987 going down to almost nothing, that's the amount that we're removing actually from the forest. So you can see there's a huge disparity, and that's the issue that we have with our forest now, is that we have a lot of excess material in the forest. Okay, the next slide, we're talking about jobs and economy. That's an old picture. It was kind of casual, I guess. The next slide is talks about 251 mill closures and 24,442 lost jobs since 1980. And the interesting part of this slide, if you can see, most of these lost jobs and mills are in the valley. I mean, I was always under the impression that, Eastern Oregon is severely affected, but I've looked at the four counties of mine way up in Eastern Oregon. There's, I think, eight mills. I mean, it's pretty significant for our part of the country. But if you start looking at it, it's really significant for the valley. So, if you're looking at, this is not an east-west issue, this is a statewide issue. Okay, the next slide, we're talking about statewide timber harvest. The top line is the biological potential. That's about, 10 billion board feet of lumber. These in board feet. And you can see the federal forest line starting in 1989, 1990, the decline in forest that forest harvest that we've had. And you can also see the private and the state forest or everything other than federal has stayed pretty even all through this time period. The next slide is the Oregon forest sector employment. You can see, well, they just dropped from somewhere in the 90s to 100, down bound about 68 to 70,000 jobs that we've lost. And the following slide on adjusted inflation dollar distributed per student, and this is, I think you could do this across the board. I think Senator Morris has some studies talking not only about education, but talking about health care and public safety that the, well, here we go. Wow.
Oh, wow.
Oh, here we go. There's hope for us, yeah. And inflation-adjusted dollars, and so we're certainly not on an uptrend. We were trying to in the early 90s or mid-90s when we were doing the high-tech boom, but we've lost that. And so my theory here is that we need to expand our economy, and forest industry obviously brought us to the dance at one particular time, but no longer is doing that. So the following line is, I have the new circle of prosperity. This is just my idea of this thing, creating opportunities for Oregonians, reducing poverty and crime, that sort of thing. That will in turn develop a clear and appealing environment, talented workforce, and then you get diverse value-added jobs. The following slide is a forest sector share of traded sector employment. If you notice along the Columbia River there, that light green, that's the least reliant upon the on the forest, and of course down in Malheur County and Senator Ferriola's district, and the other areas are indicated with the colors medium and high. You can see that as it is. Okay, the next slide is job multipliers for Oregon forest sectors, and these figures are all taken from forestry magazines, from the Oregon Department of Forestry or U.S. Forestry. We try to be very careful in our biases with these particular things. But you can see that the forest industry has a potential, at least, to create a huge multiplier effect for employment, and so that we could probably do that. These next three slides are just some newspaper articles that have come out 5 years in the Clinton plan. Basically, what I've been told, and I think some of these folks will tell you, that if we could just get back to the amount that was contemplated by the Clinton plan, which is to be about another billion board feet of lumber, we'd be in pretty good shape. It would be a very good program. The next one is the Bush administration overhauls forest management rules. Well, there's a change in their approach to this, and basically that's part of this bill is the forest stewardship contracts. The federal government is coming to the states. I believe Utah and Colorado have forest stewardship contracts that they're working on at this particular time. And then the last slide is the forest policy beyond salvage, which is from the local Oregonian here in March of this year, just basically saying that we need to do something, we need to change this. And I think you probably also handed out an article that we had last night on Sunday's paper, that there is some work going on now in Central Oregon with environmental groups saying that we need Senator Ferriola has it, that there's a rare alliance favors thinning of forests. So I think what we're doing is pretty timely. I know we have a lot more educated folks out here that probably could discuss the bill in depth, and so I would get out of their way and allow them to step forward and present their expertise. But thank you for your time and ability to hear this bill.
Thank you. Excellent presentation. Questions for Senator Nelson? Sir Ringo.
I just had a comment. We, I guess it was in February, had the very bloody and unfortunate battle over the appointment to the Board of Forestry. And you were a staunch defender of Chris Heffernan, and I think by all accounts he's a good member. There are some people, but frankly, I guess from my perspective, somebody that was pro-conservation oriented really was smeared in a very unfortunate way. And one of the things that some people contemplate is putting the Board of Forestry in more of a management role on federal forests. And, I think it's an interesting idea. I think there's a lot of advantages to local control. But some people are wondering, well, if this board is going to be so timber-focused, then we really have to think carefully about that. And I just would like to think that somewhere in the Board of Forestry, and whether I'm not saying replacing Chris Heffernan was the right way to do it, but somewhere on the Board of Forestry there needs to be room for people that can not apologize about their desire to protect conservation values.
Yeah. Chair Brown and Senator Ring, that's a good question. We talked about maybe not that specific instance, but the fact of the representation. I think you'll see through this bill that there's directions for the Board of Forestry to not only be involved with themselves, but the Department of Environmental Quality, Fish and Wildlife, interested party groups. We've tried to make this so this is inclusive. And overreaching all the same, remember, we're still dealing with the federal government.
That's right.
We're not going to do anything unless the federal government says you guys can do it. And I think there's a lot of public input involved in that process is what my understanding is. So,
thank you.
Appreciate your question.
Thank you very much, Senator Nelson. Enjoy your stay in Costa Rica. How long are you going to be there for?
3 weeks.
We'll still be going.
All right. We have a number of people signed up to testify on this. Senator Deck. Senator, I'm looking for Senator Devlin because I thought he was going to be here about 2 o'clock. Okay. All right. So I'll let him go. 29, we need Senator Westland on that bill. I did that one already. Okay. I'll go ahead and get started on this hearing, but we have a number of people signed up. So, Ms. Guest, Mr. Hyken, why don't you two come on up, and then Geisinger, Brown, and Graney on deck, Wilkerson, Hazelwood, including in the hole. Yeah.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mary Ann Guest, representing the Wild Salmon Center. And before I start, I'd like to compliment Senator Nelson for his reaching out to the conservationists and working with us to make this bill actually a much better bill. And it's refreshing to find such goodwill in this session. And so thank you very much. We support the concept of using biomass as an alternative energy source, but caution that biomass removal from our forests may not be the magic cure-all that it's been purported to be. I'm just going to highlight some of the issues. Fire has played an important role in the development of aquatic and riparian systems, particularly in the western United States. Additionally, comparisons of certain known harmful effects of logging against effects of wildlife, which could be neutral or even beneficial to aquatic systems, suggests that tactical logging intended to reduce fire risk poses as much or more risk to aquatic and riparian ecosystems than the fire itself. Fire, in fact, often has much less impact on natural ecosystem components than traditional silviculture practices such as clear cutting, high grading, or even some current thinning projects. Specifically, many of the Oregon's forests are not just tolerant of fire, but are in fact dependent upon it. For instance, water temperature in forested rivers and streams is less sensitive to fire because, unlike clear cutting, fire tends to burn less frequently in riparian areas and results in standing dead vegetation, which helps minimize temperature increases. Fire also is less harmful to fish populations than management efforts designed to mitigate fires and restore forest production and aquatic habitats. With that in mind, we would ask this committee to move slowly on the issue in our exuberance to manage our way out of problems. We don't want to overmanage this problem with active management. Senate Bill 1072 adds another resource extraction industry to Oregon Department of Forestry's mission, which is already struggling to find balance between timber harvesting and the environment. While such a mission may be one the department may ultimately excel at, it is imperative that we approach these new programs with a sense of caution and humility. Additionally, any investment in biomass infrastructure should reflect the temporary nature of the problem and the proposed solutions. If 60 years ago our predecessors had known that permanent dams and their associated reservoirs would help drive our salmon and steelhead run to the brink of extinction and further impoverish Native American communities, they may have acted more cautiously. It would be a mistake to turn our forests into the equivalent of manufacturing components as we have with our rivers. We ask the committee's support to require strong environmental protections, include other state agencies with appropriate expertise, and we also ask, feel it's important to engage the public in this discussion. The bill lacks, originally as it was written, it lacked a definition of biomass, which needs to be clarified to avoid future problems. Biomass should not include municipal waste and trees that are important to the health as forests, water quality, and fish and wildlife habitat. We support amendments to require a report following the implementation of a biomass project on the effects of biomass collection and conversion on the plant and wildlife resource and air and water quality of the state. This will increase agency accountability and help ensure future biomass projects achieve their stated goals. Senate Bill 1072 is really two bills, or two issues in one. One targets ODF to promote utilization of biomass to generate electricity, and the other targets management of federal lands. Actually, the bill is not necessary to enact any of this. It's already being done. Biomass projects are already beginning to take place in Oregon, and the state already has the ability to enter into contracts with the federal government. The bill appears to add weight and momentum to these issues, and we're somewhat reluctant to jump on the train and wave our arms saying this is the answer to the problems. From our perspective, to imagine a new economic sector based on logging and burning trees, even with environmental safeguards, is problematic. We do not want to add another problem to an already entrenched situation. We urge the committee to bolster the environmental safeguards and to direct Oregon state agencies to move cautiously when helping to manage lands that belong to all Oregon, all Americans. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Guest. Mr. Hyken.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Doug Hyken, and I'm here representing Oregon Natural Resources Council. We have 6,000 members who support our mission to protect and restore Oregon's wildlands, wildlife, and water as an enduring legacy. And as you're all well aware, forests in Oregon generate a lot of passion. And we think that biomass utilization can be part of the solution to restoring our forests. They can also take us in the wrong direction. Our forests have been mismanaged for a very long time. And if this biomass utilization is done carelessly, we can actually be destroying the old growth habitat that we're trying to protect, and we can actually make the fire hazard worse. By removing too much of the forest canopy, we're letting more light and air in there, we're drying out the fuels and increasing the risk of intense fire. So our main interest here is to making sure that the biomass utilization is done in a very cautious, careful way. That will require that we protect old-growth trees. It will require that we not build any more roads in our forests. We already have a huge backlog of road maintenance needs. And that we shouldn't be doing things like burning toxic waste in these generating plants. We should be using just small-diameter material from our forests primarily. We also think that these facilities must be conservatively scaled to ensure that there's a long-term supply without harming the ecosystem. We don't want to overbuild the system so that we end up chewing up more forest than we need to. So being very conservative in the size of the plants is important. We also support use of the governor's strategy for Eastside Forest Health, which requires prioritizing our efforts. We shouldn't be, painting with a very broad brush out there. We should be focusing on areas near communities. We should be focusing on protecting the resources that we value the most, including wildlife habitat and drinking water supplies. We also want to recognize that burning biomass to generate electricity is only one of the uses, very valid uses of biomass. We can use the small diameter material to make fence posts, framing poles, firewood, chips, pulp, even small diameter or small dimensional lumber. These are all valid uses of biomass. So maybe the state should be a little bit broader in the utilization they're promoting, and not just for electricity, but for these other uses as well. The second part of the bill that puts Oregon Department of Forestry in a privileged position with respect to federal lands gives us a little more concern. Other state agencies, we also feel, have very strong interest in the way federal lands are managed. Department of Environmental Quality relies on our federal forests to protect the watershed so that we have very high water quality coming from the forests into our cities for people to drink. Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife relies on federal forests to protect habitat for the fish and wildlife that we hunt and fish and that we enjoy viewing. In fact, many farmers rely on high-quality habitat on federal lands to hold the deer and elk on the federal land so they're not decimating their croplands in the lower elevation. So we need to make sure that these values are still sustained. So other agencies should be equally involved with the Department of Forestry in making recommendations for federal forest management. We feel that the governor ideally should retain the discretion to appoint whichever agency he or she feels is most appropriate for getting these things done. And we think there is an appropriate role for the state to be involved in federal forest management, but make sure that it's all the state agencies involved and that the governor retains discretion. The final concern with this part is that there really isn't a state policy for how we think federal forests should be managed. We have policies for state lands and for private forestry, but we think that we're handing ODF a little bit too much of a blank slate here if we don't constrain their discretion and have a very articulate policy for how we think federal land should be managed so that we get clean water, wildlife habitat, recreation values, and everything else we expect from federal forests. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Ringo.
Thank you. Thanks for coming today. Doug, I had a question. Do you think that we are under-harvesting federal lands?
Well, we don't think that harvesting is really the proper view to have for federal lands right now. We over-harvested for so long that what our forests need right now is restoration. And luckily, there's a great combination of interests that can come together right now. We can restore forests and create jobs and produce some wood products as a byproduct of that restoration. And all these things can come together in a very positive way. But if we look at our forests, our federal forests, as something that needs harvesting, we're probably going to make the problems that we've seen in the past worse. There is a wide variety of forests out there, private forests, state forests, federal forests, and our federal forests is where we expect those non-harvest values to come from, the habitat, the clean water, and so we need to protect that.
So, Ringo.
Everybody talks about balance. I guess that's what I would say. We need to balance all these interests, but we are harvesting substantially less than was contemplated under the Clinton plan. And I'm just wondering, is that a problem? Do we need to increase our harvest targets up to what the Clinton plan contemplated?
Well, there's the Clinton plan applies west of the Cascades, which are primarily a wetter type of forest, which isn't targeted for these fuel reduction treatments. So I'm generalizing a little bit, but it's good to be clear that the Clinton plan applies west of the Cascades. Now, there is a way to implement the forest plan that provides more wood products and more jobs and is better for the habitat, and that's the direction we want the federal agencies to go. That is to protect the mature and old-growth forest and shift the agency's effort into the younger stands. They created millions of acres of clear cuts in decades past, and those trees are now at a size that they can be cut down and put through a mill, and there's beneficial thing that can be done on all these old clear cuts. So we strongly urge the agencies to move into this less controversial realm of management and provide great benefits to the entire state.
Senator Ringo?
Just looking at the bill for a minute, and I guess we're looking at the -2 amendments, you raised a number of concerns that to me seem completely valid, completely legitimate, but what does that mean in terms of us passing the bill?
The -2 amendments are the result of a lot of discussions with Senator Nelson and others, and we think that most of our concerns have been addressed. I think our bottom line is that we can support the biomass sections of the bill. We would prefer that the governor retain all discretion to appoint whichever agencies they want. And so the part of the bill that puts ODF in a privileged position with respect to federal forests, we would rather see that part eliminated. But we can qualifiedly support the biomass provisions. And we thank all the work that's been done to come to a compromise on those.
Senator Ringo.
Do you think with some tweaking you can get there on the other half?
Well, we just got these, at the beginning of this hearing, so we haven't had a chance to go over them in detail.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you both. Senator Farioli.
Madam Chairman, thank you. I think the challenge that we have, not only in this bill, but in terms of how we approach forest management in the next decade or more, is that we've got some folks that have long held the belief that there should be no commercial harvest on federal land base, and they refer to those as the non-harvest values for wildlife, habitat, watershed, etc. They have acquiesced to the idea that some forest products could be byproducts of rehabilitation and restoration treatments. The difficulty with that is that when you come to closure on an agreement with a group of folks who believe that there can be a balance of commodity production, the non-harvest values, and the necessity for thinning, you will always find another group who repudiates that utterly and no compromise in defense of Mother Earth. So the problem that we end up with is that there are various groups articulating the possibility of compromise, but we have not compromised. We don't get to the product of compromise. So the interesting equation that I see playing itself out, particularly on the East Side landscape, is the folks in the environmental community are not happy with the 40% mortality that we see routinely in East Side forests. The mills are not sustainable with the local production from forests that are located there. They're still dragging in logs from other states and sometimes other countries. And the community economics are a disaster. So I don't see that the environmental community, the local community, or the manufacturing community are getting what they need to be sustained. And that's because we in the middle keep letting folks on the edges overturn the possibility of compromise. So I guess I would suggest that if Senator Nelson's bill can become a vehicle for compromise, that we ought to utilize it and take a step toward compromise and not allow ourselves to be essentially gridlocked by the folks who just cannot philosophically allow anything to move forward. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Ioli. Anything else with this panel? Thank you both very much. Appreciate your time and energy today. Mr. Geisinger, Mr. Brown, Mr. Graney, and then I'm sorry I didn't see next up Wilkinson, Miller, and Hazelwood. If you could make your remarks really brief and probably combine them to the Dash 2 amendments, that would be extremely helpful.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Geisinger. I represent Associated Oregon Loggers. We're a trade group of about 1,000 independent contractors involved in the logging industry and associated businesses. We support the objectives of Senate Bill 1072, articulated by Senator Nelson, restoring forest health and creating jobs. There's a huge opportunity to do that. I came here this afternoon to offer my unqualified support for Senate Bill 1072. However, I've just in the last 30 minutes have had a chance to look at the Dash 2 amendments, and I will be offering my qualified endorsement of Senate Bill 1072.
It sounds like Senate Bill 1028, Mr. Senator Ferrioli.
Well, Madam Chair,
Madam Chair,
58% of the forest land in our state are owned by the federal government, and on the east side of the Cascades, where most of these forest health problems occur, three-quarters of the forest land is owned by the federal government. So it's only logical that the state of Oregon focus its influence and desires and objectives on how those lands ought to be managed through the forest planning process. Much of these forest lands have become susceptible to insect and disease infestations. They're overstocked with too many trees. They are prone to catastrophic wildfires, as we have seen in the past several years. They need to be thinned. They need to be actively managed in order to restore forest health, and I can't overemphasize that they require immediate attention. Recognizing the severity of the situation, the current administration in Washington, D.C., over the last 3 years has initiated a number of efforts to provide the land management agencies with the tools to get the job done. President Bush initiated the Healthy Forest Initiative. Congress passed the Healthy Forest Restoration Act. A number of administrative procedures have been given to the Forest Service and the BLM to expedite decision-making and not delay it further. But unfortunately, very little has happened on the federal land since these new tools have been given to the land management agencies. Whether it's due to a lack of direction from the top, a lack of will, or concerns over environmental litigation, the restoration of these forests clearly is not on a fast track, and that's why we believe Senate Bill 1072 is both timely timely and necessary to provide a catalyst to get these land management agencies to begin the work that so desperately needs to be done. One of the cornerstones of the Bush administration's approach to federal land management is to place the decision-making authorities as close to the ground as possible, and engaging the state of Oregon through the Oregon Department of Forestry and embracing and engaging the views of local communities into the development of on-the-ground projects is very consistent with this approach. Also, when it comes to the biomass issue, market-based solutions are clearly what's necessary, and Senate Bill 1072 goes a long ways towards advocating that approach. Much of the wood fiber that needs to be removed has no merchantable value on today's market, and creating a biomass market, whether it's for generating electricity, for producing biofuels, could provide the market catalyst that's necessary to get the work done in an economic way. And I think there's a huge opportunity for economic development in rural communities that have traditionally relied on natural resources for their economic stability. I want to sound a cautionary note in that we are losing a huge amount of the infrastructure in these communities to do the work that needs to be done on the ground and to consume the material that needs to be removed. Mills have closed, logging companies have gone broke, and people have left these communities in large numbers. Senate Bill 1072 should go a long ways towards maintaining the existing infrastructure and hopefully creating an expanded capacity to use this material. And let me remind you that there's more material that can be consumed that can possibly be consumed under the existing infrastructure. Now let me turn to the Dash 2 amendments. In reading it over the last 30 minutes, I see a lot of words like shall and direct and will consult, replacing words like may and might and coordinate regarding the involvement of other state agencies. I think a lot of this is duplicative, and I think it's going to add to the bureaucracy for making decisions rather than detract from it. We need less process and less bureaucracy and more action on the ground. The federal government has a number of regulatory agencies like NOAA Fisheries, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and EPA that are doing an exuberant job of enforcing their responsibilities on federal lands. The Forest Service, in a very different light, is not doing their job, and that's why it's important and appropriate for the Oregon Department of Forestry to get in there to catalyze that federal agency and get some work done on the ground. The definition of biomass in the Dash 2 amendments is largely restrictive. Dead large trees are biomass just as much as little dead trees. Also, the requirement that these activities be socially acceptable, I think, is a very subjective requirement, and based on the appeals history of the environmental industry in this state, that requirement would doom any effort to disaster, and it wouldn't happen. A pilot project is the last thing we need. We've had too many pilot projects and not enough large-scale activity on the forest. And similarly, issuing more reports is something that's going to detract from progress rather than promote it. These are some of the concerns that we have. We will review the Dash 2 amendments much more thoroughly and ask some questions to Senator Nelson's staff to see what the real intent is. But in general, I think the Dash 2 amendments took a great idea and made it a not-so-great idea. Thank you for my comments.
Questions? Mr. Brown.
Thank you, Chair Ferrioli, members of the committee. I'm Marvin Brown, Director of the Department of Forestry, and I will keep things pretty brief. We did provide a letter earlier to the committee that indicated the Department of Forestry supports the bill, and we continue to do that, and we're more than committed to continue to work with the other interests. If there's issues, questions, we've worked pretty hard with folks all along, and we'd like to continue to work with people to make the bill happen if we can. I also delivered, at the request of the governor's Natural Resource Office, a letter indicating that the governor supports the bill. Just build on a couple of pieces that have already been talked about in terms of need. It's identified that there's about 10 million acres in Oregon that are at high risk of uncharacteristic fires. When those fires start, they're extremely damaging, they're extremely expensive, they're very difficult to put out. They're a threat to private lands that we protect. That's 10 million acres. Most, if not all, of that's on the federal land. Last year, they treated 126,000 of those 10 million acres. So that puts them on a schedule to do that over, about 75 years? Yes? I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, when you say treated, can you define that a little better for me?
Those would be the kind of treatments that are implied by harvesting small wood and other and material for biomass. It would do the thinnings and prescribe fire just to bring down the stocking level, get rid of the diseased and dying trees to try to create a stand of trees that are both better at a lower density and at a healthier condition.
So 100,000 out of 10 million, 1% they manage to get to, is what you're saying.
A little, yes, sir.
A little more than 1%.
Yes, Chair and Senator, that's about right. So the point is that it's going to take the federal government a long time to do the job at that rate, and they continue to disinvest in management. The latest federal budget will see another reduction in staffing of federal land managers in the state of Oregon. I talked to one of the forest supervisors in Oregon just last week. In 15 years, his staffing's gone from 800 people to about 250 people, and the latest budget will have him to cut that by another 14 people. So while they are continuing to fall further behind in dealing with the problem, they also continue to invest less in getting it done. And I think the other point I'd make is last October, the governor met with the Board of Forestry. He asked the Board of Forestry to engage in the federal lands issue because it was very important to the state. The board has indicated a willingness to do that. They want to do that in an open and an inclusive, very participative fashion that gets the full range of issues out in front and ultimately, hopefully, be able to create a vision that talks about why federal lands are important in Oregon, what role they need to play if Oregon's going to have a sustainable forest resource, and what do we need to do to get to that point. They are committed to doing that, and this bill just allows that direction, I think, to be institutionalized a bit. Thank you.
Mr. Brown, I've got a couple quick questions.
Yes.
I think Senator Shields has one. Is there a way to characterize the backlog in untreated acres on the federal forest lands? Do they aggregate numbers like a program approved versus program accomplished?
Senator Farioli, I'm not quite sure how retrievable that information is. We can dig it out, try to find it if you want. But like I said, right now the figure of acres at high risk is about 10 million in the state, and they're getting to, as Senator Shields said, a little more than 1% of that a year.
Okay, so the percentage of treated acres is a fraction over the percentage of high risk acres, not a percentage of the total acres.
Correct. It's
a smaller slice. Than
yeah.
The apparent. The other question I have is the governor's support for this bill. Did the governor have a chance to look at the Dash 2 amendments, or is his written support for the 1072 the main body of the bill?
The letter, Senator Farioli, was written before the Dash 2 amendments, but I participated in a discussion late Friday where we were working through some of the wording and all that, and then recommended that Mr. Carrier go ahead and sign the letter after that discussion anyway, but it was before we actually saw the everything on paper.
Okay. So I'm trying to just discern whether the governor supports for 1072 or the amended version, if that should happen.
Well, Senator, I wouldn't want to speak on behalf of the governor.
You just carry the letters.
I can do mail.
Okay. Senator Shields.
Well, I had been led to believe that the governor was supportive of the Dash 2 amendments, and so I'd like some clarification on that. But I had another question, and this is a great way for me to show my ignorance, which I've done several times before. When I need somebody to tell me something, Mr. Brown is very good at getting facts and information for me. The state forests use structure-based management. In structure-based management, don't you leave behind some of the same biomass, or do you do it differently? How do you do that in your operation, or am I totally off base in terms of understanding what biomass is? You know, I hear terms like woody debris and so on for habitat purposes. How do you do that without ending up with some of the same quote-unquote biomass problems that Senator Nelson's bill addresses or tries to address.
Well, Chair and Senator Shields, the management concepts that we apply rely a lot on thinning and reducing the stand density for properties that we own. And we do that because the trees that are remaining then have a higher likelihood of getting to complex habitat structure in a shorter period of time. In the process of taking that extra wood out of the forest so that those remaining trees can grow faster, we are doing essentially what we hope the federal lands could also do, which is reduce the density of the stands, reduce the stocking of the stands. That's what's not happening on federal land right now.
Okay, so to follow up, gathering up the biomass in a federal forest could be done very much within the concepts of your structure-based management that you've promoted on state forests.
Yes.
And yet that would enhance some of the wildlife habitat.
Yes.
Is that right?
Chair and Senator, yes, that's true, we think.
Madam Chair, I guess I had misunderstood until Mr. Brown stated me out a little bit. I had visualized biomass as just, you know, that blanket of debris that builds up over time on the forest floor, but it's a lot more than that.
Chair and Senator, we're mainly concerned with the standing trees, in dead or alive, but that they are so densely stacked into a stand that trees can't compete very effectively. They're a lot more susceptible to insect and disease. When fires do start, they're hotter. They, you know, go all the way down to the soil, damage the soil microorganisms, you know, kind of make permanent alterations to the basic biological productivity of the site. Those are the kinds of things we're concerned about.
Madam Chair, just clarification, one final question. I'm educating myself, but I hope I'm educating the committee as well. That would mean that in the old days when the forest fire periodically swept things clean, they were kind of cleaning up not just the stuff on the floor, but knocking out all those dead standing trees and so on without really harming the healthier living trees. Is that the way it works?
Yeah, Chair and Senator Shields, on the east side of the state, the forests that typically grew there throughout history were subject to fires anywhere from every 5 to 20 years. And as a result of having fires in them that frequently, they were already at a fairly low density level. There were not very many trees standing per acre. That was just a natural condition then. In the early 50s, when we introduced fire protection, that allowed, you know, that quit that event. The fires no longer got into those stands on a regular basis. And the way to keep the density down after that point was through managing those stands, of actually cutting down trees. Now, after we introduced both fire suppression and then also no longer cutting down those trees, then that's when the stands really start to get dense and start to have the problems that we see.
Sir Ferrioli.
Madam Chair, the interesting piece of this discussion to me is that when we're referring to west side forests and the moisture and the density of stands and the closure of the canopy, and then we flip over to talk about the east side forests, they're just not comparable. But the one thing I hear Mr. Brown saying, which I know to be true, is that the period between 1873 and 1973, in 1873, the east side forests were still being managed by Native Americans with fire. And they would come into the areas in the wintertime and set fires that sometimes ranged throughout the fall and were only put out by winter snows, and some burned again the next spring. And when the pioneers and settlers moved into the area, they could easily drive a wagon across the forests in the Blue Mountains because the spacing between trees was quite significant. Today, when you can't ride a horse through that country. It is so dense, it's hard to walk through a lot of that country. And that's because of the absence of fire and the fire suppression that was a European approach and modified by Americans for fast and rapid initial attack and removal of fire from the ecosystem as much as possible. That's incompatible with long-term forest health on the east side. And that's where we are right now. They're tinder dry. They're way overstocked. So stand management and stocking control, spacing, competition for moisture and all those things, bug infestations, all play into this, which brings us back to the Board of Forestry role. Board of Forestry and the Department of Forestry have to look on an acre-by-acre basis to do site-specific prescriptions for each acre out there. You just can't make generalizations about what we ought to do, you know, from the office in Salem, and certainly not from the offices in D.C. So I'm hoping that this bill gives us the opportunity to have that acre-by-acre discussion and actually implement prescriptions on the ground.
Sarah Ringo.
Thank you. I had a question about the economics of biomass. I know that in managing our federal forests, the U.S. Forest Service has lost a lot of money managing forests. And I can't remember the figures, but so much for the Mount Hood National Forest, where despite the revenues they receive from the sales, they net a significant loss. And I'm wondering whether the biomass that's contemplated can be self-sustaining financially.
Chair Brown, Senator Ringo, that's always been a close call. I don't know if Director Graney's going to address that at all. But most of the figures that you read say that it is pretty close to not being profitable at this point, primarily because of transportation costs. I think one of the previous speakers, Mr. Hyken, talked about the fact that we don't necessarily have to burn it all to be able to make good use of the materials. And if there were a way to provide a more stable supply, I would think other markets that are more profitable could also be part of the mix. You know, markets that include small diameter wood used for lumber and things like that.
Madam Chair?
Sarah Ringo.
Well, if there's the potential for financial loss while carrying out biomass production, I'm wondering, are we willing to accept that loss in the name of forest health because we're clearing out the overstocked material and we think therefore it's just part of the cost of managing the forest? I think your answer to that is probably yes, but if so, then who's going to be paying for that? Is that a state expense, a federal expense? Where's that money coming from?
Chair Brown and Senator Rigo, we don't anticipate that becoming that supported by state funds, and we would have to be operating under a federal grant or operating under certain circumstances where a project could sustain itself economically. Those are the ways that we would envision. I know right now that a lot of those projects are costing quite a bit of money, $200 plus an acre. The thing that's important when you talk about incurring those costs is that when fires occur, to put out that fire, we're talking $5,000 an acre. So it's still a good investment, even if it's not a net return in revenue.
Well, Madam Chair, I mean, in that regard, it's a long-term investment in the health of the forest. I mean, so you spend the money now on biomass so you don't spend it 10 years down the road fighting the fire on that same acre.
Chair Brown, Senator Riegel, that's exactly right. And in addition to the cost associated with fighting the fires on those lands, the fact that those lands represent a substantial risk to private lands that are adjacent to them increases our cost of protecting those lands. We simply have to be more vigilant because of the risk that exists on federal lands. And that's an additional state cost right now that's not supported by the federal government.
Thank you. Are there examples of I don't know what to call it, whether it's biomass forest management or biomass operations in place in Oregon right now? I mean, we've got a couple cogen facilities, and we had another bill related to cogen last week. But how extensive, if we want to see the kind of on the ground operations that we're contemplating with this bill, where could we look?
Chair Brown, Senator Rigo, I know that the Forest Service is working with some local interests in the Lakeview area on a project that's focused pretty specifically on that. If you wanted to look at the kind of management that we would propose on those east side forests, I think Sun River state forest, our Sun Pass State Forest would be a good example, because our management concepts there are strictly built around forest health, and what we don't clear cut those properties. We work strictly with stand density management on those lands, and it would be, I think, a good example of what we think would be a good forest management approach.
I mean, is that a place where you're specifically removing the overstocked material and in the name of forest health?
In the name of Chair Brown and Senator Regal, in the name of forest health, but also we do generate net revenue from that land.
And how do you do that? What happens to the materials that are removed?
They're bought by sawmills and local industry.
All right. Mr. Graney, I know you would love to testify. Unfortunately, I need to put this public hearing on hold. I've got Senator Westland waiting here. We're going to hear Senator Westland on 2932, and then we're going to be on the floor at 3 o'clock. I'm hoping to recess the committee until 4:30. I'd like to continue this conversation on 1072 and wrap up the other business that's on our agenda today before our 5:30 hearing starts. We will not move 1072 today. I just want to run it through up the flagpole and make sure folks are okay, but we would like to get this back scheduled very, very soon. So with that, we're going to temporarily close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1072, open a public hearing on House Bill 2932. We heard this earlier. Senator Westland, fire away.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Senator Ben Westland, District 27. I have the dash two amendments, which I don't know if have been explained. They functionally begin.
No, on, they have not.
They begin on page 6. And what this bill does, first of all, House Bill.
We're on House Bill 2932, and Senator Westland, Representative Nelson came to testify on the underlying bill earlier. Senator Westland would like to propose the dash 2 amendments, which he's already spoken with Representative Nelson about.
I have already spoken with Representative Nelson. She has given us her full blessing. We have vetted this in Senator Ringo's committee, and in essence, to be very short, what this allows Oregon to be able to do is expand the definition of community centers. Currently, the definition of community center does not include uses by veteran services. This amendment would extend the definition of community centers within existing structures only, within half a mile or less of city boundaries, to include those services provided by veteran services.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
It's clear that Senator Westland has been perusing relating clauses.
No, that's fine.
No, we did hear this relating to a bill. The bill said relating to EFU. But it's a good bill. Keep talking.
Yeah. I guess I have to plead guilty to being an EF or a relating to clause peruser. In essence, the issue is that there is no shelter for veterans east of the Cascades. This would be the first and only one. We should have more, but we can't have this one because it's in an EFU. This would be in an existing old fire shelter with, you know, the kitchen and the beds and all the appurtenant amenities that would make it desirable for such a use. It is within about 30 yards of the new fire station. It's just an abandoned government building that the fire district is very willing to give to a veterans outreach group, a nonprofit veterans outreach group, that would be happy to turn it into a veterans service center, but for want of an expansion of the definition of community centers, which are already allowed, and already allowed land use exception outside of UGBs on EFUs. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. I think I got it, Charlie. You got it.
Thank you, Senator Westland. We would move the bill, except that we asked, Senator Farrelly asked that we wait and bring it back at 4:30 so he could be here to move it as well. So, Senator Shields, any questions or comments?
No.
All right. Thank you very much.
Good bill. Should pass. Thank you.
Good job. Okay. All right. Since we've got a few more minutes, did Graney leave? Mr. Miller, is he right outside? Mr. Graney, see if we can get him on.
Jennifer, you live in Senator Brown.
I just totally disagree. I mean, I'm sorry. Mr. Graney, come on up. Sorry, Senator Westland was so succinct and articulate, he didn't take up very much time. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2932, open public hearing on Senate Bill 1072.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mike Graney, Director of the Department of Energy. We also support Senate Bill 1072. We think this can help develop more biomass energy, both for electricity and for fuel. As Senator Nelson noted, that's one of the priorities of the Renewable Energy Action Plan that the governor adopted earlier this year. Let me just mention a couple of things in part two to address Senator Ringo's questions about cost effectiveness. We did a study about a year ago of the three northeast counties of biomass potential, and there's over 700,000 tons a year of excess material, even taking into account what's needed for forest health and reinvigoration of the forest from decay. With that 700,000 tons a year, that would support 50 megawatts of electricity, either in small projects or one large one, and that's as much energy as the wind farm at Condon is producing, or three times as much as the wind farm at Klondike near Wasco. So this is significant energy, and that's just from those three counties. And that would help reduce our continued use of coal and natural gas for electricity for fossil fuels. So it's a way of helping our energy needs, but also helping environmental impacts. In terms of sort of the cost effectiveness of individual projects, where it's been most cost effective is where you've got existing lumber mills, for example, that can use cogeneration. And we've have a number of those throughout the state, Medford, Roseburg, a number of sites in northeast Oregon. But where you'd be specifically gathering the fuel for standalone energy facility, the gathering costs and transportation costs have been the biggest barrier. The incentives we have for renewable energy do apply to biomass. So the existing tax credits, for example, and low-interest loans have been used by people that have used cogeneration using wood waste. And the biofuels package that's coming over from the House.
House Bill 3481?
Yes, that has incentives both for agricultural products, but also forest waste, both for electricity generation and for fuel. So that would provide additional incentives. So on the whole, we support the bill and think it's a good direction.
Thank you. Questions, Senator Ringo.
Thank you. Do these cogen facilities produce much in the way of air pollution?
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, they produce less than fossil fuels. They produce some, but they're certainly they're cleaner than just open burning, for example. They're cleaner than much cleaner than coal plants, and none of the CO2 emissions that natural gas plants have.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Shields.
What, do you have concerns about, I'm just trying to visualize the gathering of biomass. The building of roads and all of the infrastructure would have to go into that process?
I'm Senator Shields. I don't think, for the most part, what we've looked at is using, in the study that we did, was using existing roads. I mean, there's already formerly logging roads there in this area. The biggest problem is simply moving the material in terms of the cost. It's not requiring new infrastructure. It's just the physical gathering and transportation of the material.
I guess I'm missing something, Madam Chair, because
Senator Shields.
It would seem to me that there would be some areas that haven't been given much attention in a long time, and therefore you'd have to. I've seen
what a logging road looks like after it's not been used for 10, 15, 20 years.
Right.
You know, and right. Given what we've done to some of our national forests, I don't think anybody's been to some of those places in a while.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Shields, I expect there to have to be some, you know, some improvements, but this doesn't call for, you know, the costs involved are not involving large-scale road building. And each specific site we'd have to look at in terms of, knowledge from both the state and federal departments of forestry.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Graney. Appreciate you rejoining us.
Me.
We're going to close the public hearing temporarily on House Bill, on Senate Bill 1072, and we're going to be in recess till approximately 4:30. If folks can't stay around, let me know, and we'll figure out a way to get your testimony on the record tomorrow. All right, let's go back on the record on Senate Bill 1072. Wilkerson, Miller, Hazelwood, and Mr. Kluding, why don't you come on up? Oh, Richard, are you here? Never mind.
No, wait, Polly. We have more members.
Okay, that's fine. Why don't you come on? Did we lose Lee Hazelwood? Okay, I have his written testimony, and we will submit it for the official record. Good afternoon. How are you?
Good.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ray Wilkerson, Oregon Forest Industries Council. I will be very brief. I'd just like to go on record on behalf of OFIC in support of Senate Bill 1072, and would also like to go on record on behalf of OFIC to express our gratitude to Senator Nelson, who's worked very hard on this bill and sincerely is trying to solve a problem that has eluded a lot of people in the past. So that's basically what I wanted to put on the record. I'd also like to put on the record that we concur with the testimony you heard earlier from Mr. Geisinger, who is probably as smart as anybody in this building about the history and the management of federal forest lands, has a long career in that arena and knows a lot about it, and we concur fully with his testimony, including his reservations about the Dash 2 amendments. There are some things there, particularly related to some of the definitions I think Mr. Miller is going to touch on, that we would share those concerns. And the final thing I'd like to say is also in the way of concurrence with State Forester Marvin Brown, who mentioned that this is a problem not only for directly for federal lands, but for adjacent private lands that are threatened by the unhealthy condition of federal forests and in terms of insects and disease and fire and that sort of thing. So OFIC members have both an indirect and a direct reason to be supportive of this idea to get the federal forests back in shape. We appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Miller.
For the record, Greg Miller, Government Affairs Manager for Horauser Company. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak to Senate Bill 1072. We do support the base bill 1072. Would support the Dash 1s. You asked us to confine our remarks to the Dash 2s, so I'll do that in the interest of time. We can't support the Dash 2s in its current form, mostly for two very particular reasons. On page 3, lines 5 and 6, it talks about in consultation, the State Board of Forestry, and it's irrelevant to the consultation with the governor, but may, and goes over to page 4 and directs the Oregon State University and Department of Fish and Wildlife and Oregon Forest Resources Institute. And we would prefer that the bill language on page 4, line 5, subsection 6, talk about cooperate with as opposed to direct. So that's one area that we would like to see some changes to.
Okay.
The second item that we would like to see some changes to, and there's a lot of options that you could approach this with, is the definition of biomass. And that is on page 5, lines 24 through lines 7 on page 6. And in my handout, I gave you some material there that I won't go through in any great detail, but you have basically two options, I think. You could either strike that language as it's defined in terms of forest biomass or woody biomass and let the agency work through that issue. I think, and as I talked to the state forester out in the hallway while you folks were on the floor, it's his impression that what the intent of that portion of the bill is, as he was talking to other stakeholders, was to talk about the prescriptions that are applied on the ground relative to forest biomass removal, as opposed to a definition of forest biomass.
Okay.
The other way you could do this is to, I've given you three options, or I've given you really one definition that it's actually an industry standard. It's the AFMPA definition of forest biomass that's been vetted at the national level. It's accepted at the by the forest products industry, and that's in the handout. You could adopt that as a definition of forest biomass. I'm sure glad this is going on record since I have your undivided attention.
Yeah.
And just kidding. And the other option is that in House Bill 3481, which is coming over to your chamber, has a definition of forest biomass or biomass.
You provided to us.
Yes, I provided
which
for
is
you.
Very a very impressive lobbying technique.
You're very welcome. But who knows if that gets adopted? But that definition has been vetted. And the other point I wanted to raise is I gave you a copy of the Oregon PUC's discussion paper on cogeneration, forest biomass, biomass in general. And there's a discussion in there about biomass, and there's the similar language, very straightforward in terms of what is acceptable to us in terms of biomass. And the reason why I raise this issue is because in this definition, it would eliminate or discriminate against spent pulping liquor. And there's a fact sheet in there about spent pulping liquor, what it means to the forest, to the pulp and paper industry, and how you generate electricity using spent pulping liquor. So with that, I would close my remarks and hope that we could make some changes in the dash twos, if that's what you accept. But my number one option is to take the dash ones.
I'm advertising.
Thank you.
Mr. Clooney, before you ask questions, let's go through the panel. Go ahead, Mr. Clooney.
Thank you, Chair Brown. Committee, first, may I apologize for Lee Hazelwood. He had to leave for a doctor's appointment.
No problem. We have his written testimony. He's here on record on support of the bill.
For the record, I'm Bill Clooney. I represent the Western Council of Industrial Workers in Oregon. We have close to 5,000 members throughout Oregon. Our members depend on healthy forests. Oregon has many natural resources, and it is our duty and obligation to protect, enhance, and make sure that our resources remain stable, yield for now and the future. I appreciate Senator Nelson bringing this long overdue bill forward. We've needed Senate Bill 1072 a long time. Remember a few years ago, if I may take you back, there was a commercial on TV, and it showed a North American native standing on a rise looking out over what was once his land. Nothing was really said, but all of a sudden the tears started coming down his cheek. So if he could see our forests today, our federal forests, those same tears would flow. That's how bad our forests are. You really don't really notice how bad they are until you get to a boundary where our good State Forest Practices Act, our state forests, border a federal forest, or private lands border a federal forest. You'll be amazed at the difference. Senate Bill 1072 has a capability, is a tool to correct this disservice to our federal timberlands. It also enables our state foresters to partner up and state agencies to partner up with the federal agencies and make sure our forest programs are put together correctly for all people in this state and nation. We could create hundreds, thousands of jobs in this state if we'd done this forest program right. Created tax dollars for our counties and state, and find viable uses for the biomass or thinning that needs to be done in these forests. We urge you to do pass Senate Bill 1072, and I'll take any questions.
Thank you. Okay, now questions. Senator Shields.
Well,
I'll let you get back to you. I think it's interesting is the environmental community is not really excited about the dash twos, and the timber industry is not very excited about the dash twos. So I think we're, you know, at least right on target there. At least that's my sense. Sarah Nelson has done amazing work on this one. Sarah Shields.
In other words, if he gets everybody a little bit unhappy, you must be doing a good job. I notice you have a definition that you had given us of biomass, and it's kind of different from the definition of biomass in dash 2.
Correct.
And is this competing definitions, or is one authoritative and this one is full of hot air? I mean, can you explain the difference?
I have no way to explain the proponents of the dash 2 amendments. I don't know what's the intent there.
You don't know where they got their definition.
I'm saying that the definition that I would be very comfortable with as Weyerhaeuser, and I don't speak for the entire industry, but as the pulp paper sector and as a co-generator in this state relative to biomass and with a lot of experience in the use of forest biomass, we'd be very comfortable with the definition that I gave you that's been vetted at the national level, the definition that is in House Bill 3481 that's coming over your way, and also with the way the Oregon PUC has characterized forest or biomass.
And Sarah Shields, I just want to recall the bill we heard on Friday. Was it Senate Bill 1082 regarding Warm Springs biomass regeneration? I think we had the same issue in that particular bill as well.
I don't think it had a definition in there.
It didn't.
No.
I know that's the problem with the bill.
So you want a definition, or someone wants a definition in there. Well, I would suggest that if you wanted to look at a definition for forest biomass, that those what I've given you is a great place to start.
Excuse me, Madam Chair. It seems the main difference has to do with the pulping liquor.
Yes.
And can you explain? I've read this carbon neutral paragraph, but I guess you've got to make it fifth grade level or something. I don't quite understand why it's carbon neutral. I mean, it's talking.
What are you looking at, please?
I'm looking at the benefit of using pulping liquor for renewable energy.
Oh, the fact sheet.
That fact sheet. It's talking about a closed loop. It doesn't add CO2, but is a pulping liquor within the system? Is that how it's part of the closed loop?
If you'd focus on the flow sheet there on the front, the front of the sheet of the flow chart, and the closed loop system comes in where the pulping process breaks down with the chemical recovery. This is the green part, the green arrow that flows up into the two boxes, the biomass stream generation and the chemical recovery. That's the closed loop system. So the spent pulping liquor comes out into as pulping chemicals and goes back into the digestive system. We add more chemicals to that, and the lignin that is separated from that is what's burned and generates the electricity. It's burned, it generates the steam. Steam goes into the turbine, then comes out as power or heat. So, in our view, lignin is a wood waste, and that is what is used to generate the energy, and the inorganic chemicals comes back into the system. That's the closed loop part. It goes back into the digestion of the pulp to render the pulp into paper.
Madam Chair, it occurs to me that you have two non-scientists talking to one another. Maybe you are a scientist. I don't know, but I heard you say something about you're adding the pulping chemicals. Do they become part of the liquor that gets burned?
That gets separated out.
They get separated.
Yes.
In that.
That's why I provided the
evaporation box on there. Is that where they get separated out again?
Right. Come back again to the as it comes through. Back into the biosteam generation and the chemical recovery. It's a recovery boiler, Senator.
Senator Ringo.
I'm not sure I understood that. In fact, I'm pretty sure I didn't. I'll follow up with you. Greg, you mentioned, I think, two objections to the dash twos.
Correct.
One is the language direct OSU and other, you'd rather have it say cooperate with. Sure. I mean, Madam Chair,
seems
reasonable to me. I don't know how one agency could direct the other agency in that regard anyway, but that seems reasonable to me. The other one I'm trying to understand a little better, the biomass issue. What is it about the definition here that is specifically objectionable to you? the definition in the current bill?
In the dash twos? Well, first of all, it doesn't include spent pulp and liquor. And there are, and basically it excludes it specifically on the next page.
I see.
You see that?
Yes.
Where it says does not include
black liquor.
Yeah. And okay. I'm saying spent pulping liquor, it's referred to as black liquor.
I see.
Some people think it's a cocktail, but it's a joke.
Yeah, I got it.
Well, you know.
Madam Chair,
Senator Ringo,
is this an issue that you had discussions with Senator Nelson, with the enviros on this, that you just couldn't come to terms with? Or
no, sir.
So this hasn't been the subject of discussion?
Chair Brown, Senator Ringo, no, sir. In fact, our dialogue with Senator Nelson has been on the basic concept. We're supportive of Senate Bill 1072, supportive of the dash ones, looked at those. The dash twos are brand new for me today. Had my first shot at looking at it, and that's where I raised the issue. I raised that issue with Senator Nelson just prior to the hearing, talked to him in the hallway. He said, well, get me something. That's why you have those definitions there. As I said, another way to approach this would be to just completely strike the definition of biomass out of the bill and leave the agency to develop guidelines or to... actually, as I was talking to the state forester in the hallway, he suggested that maybe the bill ought to just talk about the treatment. What kind of treatment do you apply to the forest relative to the removal of the forest biomass itself, as opposed to getting into the definitions of biomass?
Madam Chair, just to follow up, I know you haven't looked at the dash keys closely, but at least initially those are the only two objections, and if we take care of those two objections, then you're fine with them?
Yeah, I think so. I believe so.
Okay. And Madam Chair, if I could continue. You know, I was asking some of the earlier witnesses about the economics of biomass operations in the forest. How's it pencil out?
Well, Chair Brown, Senator Ringo, I'm not an economist, so I couldn't begin to put the pencil to it. But in general, if you have this is a very general statement, if you've got the infrastructure, for example, a sawmill located within the general wood basket, you know, it could be a 100-mile circle, it could be a 150-mile circle, I think you can make it pencil out. It's just a matter of a boiler system in your facility. And I think that's the argument you heard with the Warm Springs in terms of what they have on their plant site and making that pencil out. I think the notion, if you were to, and I didn't bring this with me, and why Senator Nelson has a lot of enthusiasm about this, is if you look at what's treatable out there on the federal side of this with our federal partners at the table, there is a level of sustainability around the wood waste itself, what's already out there in a Class 2 or Class 3 fire severity condition, where just the simple removal, thinning, selective harvest, whatever, plus what's on the ground in terms of being able to make it pencil out. There is a study that the Department of Energy has on its website that has a three-county case study over in the Blue Mountains, and they actually put the economics to it and talk about a 5-megawatt facility. But I believe that the 5-megawatt facility does have to be close to or a part of a milling facility. That's my opinion.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. We really appreciate your willingness to join us this afternoon. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1072. We don't have a lot of time. Need folks to come to closure on this one. Senator Ringo. Let's open a public hearing on SJR 9. Senator Devlin. Ms. Harris, I'll let Senator Devlin tell us about the bill. And Senator Devlin, per our previous conversation, the response to the answer to your question, whether you do short testimony or long testimony, the answer is short.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this hearing and possible work session on SJR 9.
I will not do my 30 pages of prepared testimony. I will just do a very brief overview and just a brief, very brief comments about some of the benefits of annual sessions. This is the same actual bill that was voted on in the last legislative session. Every member of this committee voted in favor of this measure in the last legislative session. In fact, this measure had perhaps the most bipartisan vote that has ever occurred in the legislature in the last legislative session. It had 10 Republicans in favor, 10 Democrats in favor, 5 Republicans opposed, and 5 Democrats opposed. Some of the no's from last session have told me that they are going to be ayes this session. This basically calls for annual sessions, 120 days for the first session, 45 days for the second session. It allows the legislature by a two-thirds vote of both chambers to extend in five-day increments those sessions. But it does not allow them to do that continuously in the sense of taking weekends off. The only day that they can take off in those five-day increments is Sunday. Just general information, I think most of you are aware of this. In the 1960s, only 19 states had annual sessions. By the mid-70s, 41 states had annual sessions. Now 44 states have annual sessions. Only 6 states have biennial sessions. And of the 6 states, Oregon is the only legislative body not to limit their biennial session. There are many benefits to proposals for annual sessions. Many people believe that we live in too complex of a world to basically deal with on an every 2-year basis. Many people believe that our process would be far more deliberative if we met on an annual basis. Many people believe that however you revise processes within these buildings, people would stay more familiar, even if they were serving less days. There are plenty of examples of states that have annual sessions that actually meet for less days than we do on a biennial basis. I think there are quite a few good reasons to do this. It has had some interesting history in the legislature. It was referred to the voters in 1989 to the 1990 ballot, failed by only 5,000 votes. Most of you that are here have been in the legislature prior to... many at least until 1995. It has been literally a topic of discussion in every session since 1995. In some cases, it has passed both chambers only to fail to get concurrence on amendments in chambers. In other occurrences, it has died in the waning hours of the session. This is a bill that I think is time has come. I think it will have a lot of benefits to this state, and I would be glad to give a much more lengthy discussion on the Senate floor.
Thank you, Senator Devlin. Should we have time some long evening? Any questions for Senator Devlin? Your charming personality and bright wit has left no questions. So with that, we're going to close the public hearing. Oh, Ms. Eaton, you want to testify? Would you come on up?
By the way, Madam Chair, the League of Women Voters have been with me for practically every presentation in this over the years.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair, and members of the committee. I will be very brief. For the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I'm the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. As Senator Devlin has referred to, we have held a position favoring annual sessions for quite some time. And as the population of Oregon has grown and the amount of money necessitated to run a state of this size has increased, our concern for annual sessions has also increased. We believe that annual sessions would make a much more efficient and effective legislature, dealing both with money and the services that are needed for the state. Thank you.
Senator Devlin.
Madam Chair, just to beg the Chair's indulgence, one thing I did want to state for the record is I think, and Senator Atkinson referred to this in a prior bill on the Senate floor, I do think one of the benefits of annual sessions and specific limits in sessions is right now we know when we start, but we don't know when we end. I think we would be much more productive if we knew when we started and when we ended.
I'm not sure anybody would disagree with that, particularly at this point in time. Thank you very much. We're going to close the public hearing on SJR 9. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 3379. 3379, Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. House Bill 3379 expands the statutory definition of peace officer to include parole and probation officers for purposes of the Oregon Criminal Code.
Okay. Ms. Botkin, Mr. DeLash, I'm going to let you bring a handful of your folks up.
Yeah. I'll come up. I'll be up with you,
Madam Chair, maybe I can start while people are getting organized behind me here for the purposes of saving time. For the record, Brian DeLeishment, representing the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers and the Oregon Council of Police Officers. I have a number of people to testify, and hopefully they'll be relatively brief. But let me give you just a little background on this bill and the reason for the bill. But a couple of notes before I go into the content of the bill. The first thing that I get asked is, does this somehow change collective bargaining as far as strikeability, non-strikeability of these employees that was decided last session? Does not. The second question I get is, does this somehow change their status in PERS? And the answer to that is no. And with that, I'll go on to the actual bill. The bill, the way it's currently crafted, and there are dash one and dash two amendments that we can comment about very briefly, but the major intent of the bill is really three prongs. One is currently under the definition of peace officer, if someone resists arrest of a peace officer, they are in fact guilty of resisting arrest. But if they resist arrest of a parole and probation officer, since parole and probation officers are not considered peace officers in the statute, there is no penalty for doing that. The same thing is if they interfere with a parole and probation officer. They are not in the definition of peace officer, so therefore they are there is no, in fact, sanction for that. To this point, I now understand that there is at least one person that's going to testify on interfering today, but up to this point, there has been no objection between the employers and the employees as to interfering or resisting, that both sides recognize that that statute needs to be changed, and in fact, there was consensus on that. What I will point out is the difference between the Dash 1 and the Dash 2 amendments, and then I'll wrap it up. The Dash 1 amendments that actually come from the proponents of the bill, FOPO and the OCPA, have a portion that begins on Section 4, bottom of page 1, that deals with the limited ability of a parole and probation officer to execute an arrest. You'll hear stories about situations in which parole and probation officers enter homes or are exposed to criminal activity, and currently under statute they only have the ability to take into custody and arrest somebody that's under their direct supervision, but yet they see criminal activity when they're in those facilities, and they can talk about that. The Dash 2s, which come from, I believe, the Oregon Community Corrections Directors, only allows arrest authority when there is an outstanding warrant if it's a non-supervised person. And so we obviously prefer the Dash 1s. We think it's probably a better public policy. But that's where the difference between seems to exist between the groups at this point. Let me wrap up by finally saying that there's been discussion between the parties about, well, lack of resources, and if these folks are going to do additional things, including arrests, then we just don't have the physical ability to do that in our jurisdiction. Let me clarify that nothing in this bill, either version, the original version of the Dash 1, requires a jurisdiction to allow their officers to execute these kinds of arrests. It's totally up to the jurisdiction as a part of their employer relationship and their job description. So if a jurisdiction decides that they see the commission of a crime as a non-supervised person, they can, in fact, instruct them that they are not to take action and go forward with that. And with that, I'll turn it over to one of the parole and probation officers.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lucinda Carroll. I've been a probation parole officer for 20 years with Washington County Corrections. I also represent the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers with its 300 members across the state. We're here in support of House Bill 3379. The original purpose of this bill was to include us in the peace officer statute. We had certain jurisdictions, district attorney's office, who declined to prosecute cases where our offenders assaulted probation officers or resisted arrest. As this bill has been amended, we feel it's made positive changes with the amendments. For example, the interference, we often go out and do home visits with our offenders. A couple months ago, we had a probation officer in Washington County who was severely bitten by a dog several times as the offender's roommate stood by and watched and did nothing to prevent the dogs from attacking her. Under this bill, she would at least have some authority to direct that roommate to secure the dogs or to get her out of what was a very bad situation. If a person under our supervision resists arrest, and it does happen, there would be no more ambiguity for district attorney's office to prosecute resisting arrest. The purpose of Section 4 is discretionary, and I think you'll probably hear from DOC that the jails are crowded. It doesn't make sense to have POs out there arresting every crime they see. That is not the purpose of this bill. When we go into offenders' homes, and in my 20 years, many times I've walked in where there's drug use, illegal drug use going on. There's a house full of people. You don't know who they are. This bill would give us at least some other tools to go in and direct what's going on in that house. You need to leave. You need to sit down and not go anywhere. Right now in Washington County, what happens when we walk into that house, they scatter. They see us come in, and people are going everywhere. Back rooms, they're going out the back door, they're going outside. We don't know what they're doing. We have no authority to handle the situation. And it can be a bad situation if they go into a back room and we don't know what they're getting or if they're going to come back out. So at least this gives us some options to say you need to leave the residence or you need to stay put in that chair and not move until we are done talking to our offenders. So we feel it is a safety issue by having that authority. We're not interested in going out and arresting every single person we come across that we think has done a crime. And we certainly will, with our training, we have the ability to handle most situations, but I certainly, in my situation, would not hesitate to call for police backup if I feel that it's necessary. We also feel this bill makes sense because in expanding or putting us in the definition of a peace officer, we would be able to serve warrants on probation violation, on our offenders for non-probation violation warrants. Right now, our practice in Washington County, and we have no authority, in our county council's opinion, to serve those warrants. We have our offenders come into a controlled setting. We see that they've got a warrant for failing to appear or a warrant for a new crime that's pending or a grand jury indictment. We have to call police off the street, take up their time, tax dollars, money for two professions that can do the same thing, and they come into our office and they walk them down the stairs and up the elevator to the jail cell. And this would allow us to do that ourselves without taking up police officers' time. Appreciate you having a hearing today, and if there's any questions.
Thank you. Yes, there's a question.
Senator?
He seemed to be looking for a chair, and I was pointing his feet. Far at the moment, the chair.
Well, I thought we would proceed through all the panelists before we got to the
question. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Brian Montgomery. I'm a parole and probation officer with Multnomah County. I'm currently assigned to the domestic violence unit, and at present I work under a federal grant, the Project Safe Neighborhoods federal grant, which targets domestic violence offenders who use a firearm in the commission of a crime, a history of firearm use, or have been labeled armed career criminals. I'll talk a little bit about how this job has evolved and the field has evolved, and to be honest with you, I think the laws have not kept pace with the evolution of that change in our job. And I'll also talk a little bit about the training that we all undergo at the police academy and additional training in our various county agencies. My colleague here left off with a scenario about not being able to serve a warrant or effect an arrest on somebody with a warrant. I'll expand on that a little bit, give you a brief scenario. If I'm sitting in my office with somebody with a known offender who's on supervision, who has a warrant that perhaps is out of a different jurisdiction or is not related to his or her supervision, by statute, currently, I'm not really allowed to effect that arrest. Now, if I release that person out into the community and that person commits a crime, injures somebody, et cetera, that puts myself and my department into a bit of a gray area as far as our liability. Conversely, if I do effect an arrest on that person and I don't necessarily have the authority to do that, what liability have I just exposed myself to? This bill will clarify some of that and give us a clear path for which to address some of those issues. I think this is not so much an omission in the law as it's just the way the job has evolved over the years. This will help address that. The current trend with supervision now, we are singling out the most violent, dangerous offenders on our caseloads. The rest of them are essentially being case-banked, put on lower levels of supervision, and we are actively supervising those most violent offenders, those involved in domestic violence, sex offenses, robberies, gun crimes, gang-related crimes, things of that nature. If we're going to present a unified front against these types of crimes and these criminals with the police, the district attorneys, the corrections departments, then as parole and probation officers, we ought not to be making our problem somebody else's. We need to work in concert and collaboration with all those agencies. This is a tool that will help us do that. This is not something that's going to make a sweeping change. We are not going to be out arresting everybody that we see committing a crime. There are anecdotal scenarios about responding to an after-hours incident and what do you do and how do you handle that. We train for those types of things, and we train for them just like police officers do and corrections officers do. And if you witness a crime happening, the training dictates you be a good professional witness. You call it in, you get a description, location, direction of travel, things of that nature. Any peace officer that runs into a dangerous situation unaided, without first calling for help, with reckless abandon, ought to be looking for other employment, and I think all of us know that and realize that. As was stated earlier, this would have little or no fiscal impact. It will essentially be adding peace officers to the communities in which they already work, giving them additional powers, additional tools to fight crime, to reduce recidivism, which is what we're really charged with doing. We all go to the same police academy, DPSST. It's a different program than what the police and the corrections officers go through. There are some elements, though, that are very much the same. For instance, we each go through 40 hours of defensive tactics training, high-risk arrests, procedures, handcuffing, ground fighting, etc. Additionally, we all receive 40 hours of firearms training. And in Multnomah County, I'm also a firearms instructor. I'm certified by the State Academy to be a firearms instructor. We train, we have the ability to train every month with our firearms. We have to qualify every 4 months with our firearm, and we have to qualify at a rate of 100%. Every officer, in order to receive and maintain their certification to carry a firearm in Multnomah County, must shoot at 100% every time they go to qualify. It's a very high standard, higher than most of the police departments in the state. We also have annual recertifications for defensive tactics, OC spray, pepper spray, tactical baton, handcuffing, things of that nature. The training is very, very similar to what police officers go through. There's a lot of things that we don't train for that we would essentially never do as parole officers, even if given the powers to arrest in certain circumstances over persons who are not on supervision. This is not going to be a sweeping change. I think it's a good bill. I think it's well written. Specifically, the Dash 1 version. And I will wait for questions later. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Chair Brown and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jennifer Cameron. I'm a parole and probation officer in Linn County. I'm not going to go into too much about what they said, but I can speak from experience. Back in 1997, our office at the time transferred under the jurisdiction of the sheriff's office, and we were given the authority of peace officers and had that authority to deal with situations that we encountered when we were in the field. And it made a big difference in how we handled situations, our safety in the field, the offenders, I guess, respect for us in our authority and knowing that we're here to make a difference, whether it be in public safety or to promote their rehabilitation, those kinds of things. We were able to take a more proactive approach. One thing I think that opponents may say is that this bill in Amendment 1 would increase our workload. I speak from experience, it did not increase our workload. In fact, it saved time in many situations because we didn't have to wait a half hour, 45 minutes for law enforcement to arrive. We were able to deal with it and leave. It did not require any additional training that we don't already receive. So I guess I'm asking for support in amendment to pass Amendment 1 because I think it's important that POs be able to act proactively in the community and be able to proactively enforce conditions of supervision. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for the panel? Thank you very much.
Just a quick question. So what I'm understanding you to say is you already got that status.
Well, I don't. In November of 2004, our office actually transferred back to the Department of Corrections.
So you had this window when you had this.
Right. For 8 years, and we had this authority, and now we don't. And we're going out into homes and not knowing, okay, do I have authority over this person? Don't I? It's really difficult when you're walking into a home and you need to be able to control a situation, even investigate a violation, who's hanging out with who's in the back bedroom, all of these things. And we need to be able to be in control of that.
Follow-up question, Madam Chair.
Senator Shields.
So in other words, having had that power and using it effectively and judiciously, you're finding it a real handicap to have stepped back, shall we say, in time and not have it anymore.
That's correct, Senator Shields. It's been a difficult adjustment for our officers.
You might clarify the reason you had that was because you were deputized.
Yes, we were. Yes, to clarify what Brian said, we were deputized. We were actually under the jurisdiction of the Wynn County Sheriff's Office.
Sure. Sir Ringer.
Could you give me what is just the single most common hypothetical you could think of where you would want this power?
I could give you one that we see quite often. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Ringo. Myself and my partner would go out to conduct a home visit. Very routine. We do it nearly every day. Knock on a door, we walk in. The known offender that one of us would supervise would be present, and there would be multiple other people and perhaps even children in the home. And we see evidence of methamphetamine use. If I had a dollar for every glass pipe that I have found, we wouldn't have any funding problems. It is so prevalent, and we see it so often. Now, we have evidence of criminal activity going on. We have one known offender, and we have several unknowns. Right now, outside of immediate officer safety issues, I'm really not allowed to deal with those other folks. Under this, if the law were changed to allow us that authority, I could temporarily detain them, ask for their ID, ascertain who they are, see if they have warrants, and respond accordingly, and also respond accordingly to the criminal activity going on. That may be an arrest. That may be nothing more than notifying law enforcement and waiting for them to arrive to follow up the investigation. But during that window of time, I have the authority to act upon the situation, make sure that I'm safe, my partner's safe, and everybody else around me is safe, and deal with those individuals.
Madam Chair?
Senator Ringo.
Just a follow-up. You know, I'm sorry, I probably missed this, but if this bill passes, will you folks get additional training?
Yeah, I think that I'm...
And you talked about training.
Yes.
I know I missed it. But.
And let me clarify, Madam Chair, Senator Ringo.
there would not be, in my estimation, a need for additional training. We already get that training. We are all trained to deal with those types of situations, and we deal with them every day. Now, if we were to be placed in a setting where we're asked to do some kind of patrol work or larger scale investigations or writing search warrants, things of that nature, yes. I don't believe we would be asked to do that. I don't think we would be asked to act outside of the scope of our duties as they currently exist. There would be no reason to. This is an additional tool that we're already trained to use. We do these. We put these types of situations, we put these into practice every day that we work. We're doing this type of thing with people under supervision. Now, this scenario I gave you about the people, the unknowns, they may be on supervision. They may be former corrections clients. They may have charges pending. How we deal with them would be no different than how we deal with our own offender immediately. Now, we may place a no-bail detainer on our offender, and let's say we find one with a warrant. We may take him into custody. The other may be involved in criminal activity directly. We may take him into custody. This would give us the opportunity to deal with all that, to act more comprehensively.
All right.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Sarah Ferrioli.
Right now, as I understand the legality, and I'll defer this to our member who is an attorney, or staff who is also an attorney. The authority for the parole and probation officer comes by agreement from the subject of the parole or probation. That person's been convicted. That subsequent to the conviction, they've qualified by at least somebody's decision-making authority for parole or probation or post-conviction supervision. Mm-hmm. And they actually sign an agreement that gives you the authority for warrantless searches and for periodic visitations and all the other stuff that you need to control that individual. It's not just a matter of the court, it's a matter of the individual accepting. But if you enter into situations where you find additional individuals on the scene who have all the constitutional protections in place, they have no motivation at the present time to engage in a confrontation with a parole officer because they know that there's only one subject under supervision. But if we confer this authority to you, do we run the risk of putting you into a constitutional confrontation for the issue of entering, doing warrantless searches, searching the entire house, and so on and so forth? And do we then do we raise the ante to the point where we make it worth a perpetrator's energy to overpower the officer or harm the officer when currently there's no motivation to do that because these folks aren't subject to your authority? But if you get this expansion of the scope of work, they are now subject to your authority. You're in the premise. You are a threat. There's more of them than there are of you. And so I guess there's a two-part question. I mean, I'm sensing that the parole and probation officer has sort of very heavy authority over the subject of the supervision and virtually none over other people. And that, in a strange sort of a way, may be the reason why parole and probation officers sometimes walk out of a test situation. Maybe with their parolee or probationer in tow, but without having to confront the other people in that room. Can you just give me a sense of where that takes us?
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Ferrioli. Couple of issues, the first of which is officer safety is paramount. That will not change at all. We always have the option of backing out. Every police officer has the option of backing out, no matter what situation they're in. No person, no police officer, parole officer, any peace officer is ever compelled to put their life in danger unnecessarily when they can back out and call for assistance, regroup, and reassess the situation. And that's how we train. We don't train to scenarios so much as we train to good tactics. We do scenario-based training, but it's to hone our tactics. With regard to searches, the people under supervision, And there is a difference between the probationer and a parolee, in that the probationer has essentially entered into an agreement with the court. The court agrees to let them out into the community. They agree to abide by certain conditions, general and special conditions. With a parolee or a post-prison supervision, they are placed under post-prison supervision without judicial oversight. They are on post-prison supervision from the day they are released, and we are charged with overseeing them, and to the board of the local control authority. When we get to a search, our burden of proof is lower than probable cause. It's reasonable grounds. That's very clearly defined, and we train to that. We also train for probable cause. We know the difference along that continuum, and I think that would address that. With a probation or a parolee, we can get to reasonable grounds sooner than we would get to probable cause within criminal activity. If it's an unknown entity, we have somebody there, and we don't know if he's on supervision. We don't know who he is, but we should probably find out. That's what this gives us the power to do, to act in a more comprehensive manner to deal with those situations. Now, as far as, you know, more of them than us and overpowering us, it could be a house full of parolees, and you're right. We could walk into a hornet's nest, and that's the time that we would back out and regroup, call for assistance, and we do that routinely. Absolutely. We also routinely walk into situations where we have a parolee or a probationer, several other people, and they're all very compliant. And several of them could have warrants and drug paraphernalia or drug, you know, controlled substances on them, and they're very compliant. Part of that is this, and this may seem oversimplistic, but to most of these offenders, in my experience, I have a good deal of it, a cop is a cop is a cop. And they're not going to look at me and think, they're just a PO, you're not going to do anything. I'm an authority figure walking in. They don't know the law necessarily as well as I do. Perhaps they do, but they certainly know I'm wearing a radio. And they certainly know that there are officers moments away, additional resources to help me out should I need it. So, yes, there are situations where, and believe me, we hear it constantly. You're not my PO. And we explain to them, yes, for the moment, yes, I am. And so let's deal with the business at hand. So, again, we don't train the scenario so much as we do good tactics, and we use those good tactics every day. This will be another tool to help us do that.
Some of what you've told me is reassuring, but I still have the sense that in dealing with your probationer or your parolee, they are acutely aware, in my opinion, that you can take immediate action and incarcerate them and revoke their parole, that you can take the steps to make that happen on your decision. There is no subsequent process. They don't have to be reconvicted.
Correct.
They can go right back to the slammer on your say-so, which I think gives a tremendous advantage and a tremendous leverage to the parole and probation officer for the parolee or the probationer. Yes. What I'm concerned about is putting folks in a situation with others who are not under that direct authority for that probation officer and raising the ante. And you said it, a cop is a cop. And if that's the case, maybe we ought to have no distinction at all between sworn officers and just make parole and probation a division of the sworn officer. Same training, same equipment, same entry tactics, same backup, same teaming, same kind of everything that we currently do with highly charged and dangerous situations. So I'm really looking at this, and maybe this is a mythology that only exists in my mind. The parole and probation officers don't get into confrontations for the most part because the parolees and the probationers know it doesn't take much to get back in the slammer. And the last person you want to talk smack to is your PO.
I would, if I may, Madam Chair, Senator, part of that is the authority we carry. Yes, absolutely, definitely. And they know we carry a good deal of authority. And we don't have to prove that they committed a new crime, only that they violated the conditions of their supervision.
Right.
What I can tell you is we use the same tactics as the police when we go in. Officer safety is paramount. We have the same equipment. Body armor, firearms, handcuffs, spray, baton, radio. Yes, we do have the same equipment and the same training. When I went through the DPSST Firearms Instructor Academy, I was one of three probation officers. The other 30 were police officers. Most of them were SWAT officers, to be honest with you, from various agencies around the state. Mm-hmm. They did not treat me differently, or the other two probation officers differently, because we were POs. They set standards. We met those standards. We passed the class, and we were certified as firearms instructors. We don't train our officers differently. I don't shoot a gun any differently than a police officer does. I don't shoot at a different target when I train. We all use similar tactics, techniques when we train on the range from similar material. Through DPSST, we go, we meet, we trade ideas and scenarios and whatnot. It's not that different when we're going in to deal with one of our probationers or parolees. But there are things that happen out in the field that, because of the way the law is written now, we are not able to deal with them as adequately and effectively as we could should we be given these additional tools.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very fascinating conversation. I need to bring up Mr. Steve, and I cannot read your last name, from Klamath Lake Counties. Why don't you come on up? When he's done with his testimony, and we're going to temporarily close the public hearing on 3379, I need to get into work session on a number of bills, and then we'll bring you guys back up. We're obviously going to be delayed for a 5:30 hearing. Sir, come on up. I can get all these guys' testimony. I don't get to hear from somebody from your neck of the woods very often. So,
thank you, Chair Brown. If I may, in the interests of time, I did stay in town after a lengthy drive to make sure that there was ample time to provide this information on this Senate bill. It is very important to me and our Association of Community Corrections Directors. However, listening to the testimony, there are several issues that I believe I would like to address and point out of concern that was brought out in testimony.
Okay. I need you to state your name for the record.
Excuse me. My name is Steve Berger, Director of Community Corrections for Klamath and Lake County. Okay. I am also here in representation for the Oregon Association of Community Corrections.
Okay.
While it was a lengthy drive, suffice it to say, obviously we are not going to be able to address all issues before this committee today. And what I would like to do is just simply say I do have a testimony. There are issues that we would like to present, and I am willing to come back when we are able to put forth full testimony before the committee with my peers.
You know what? Here's what I would suggest is that we get what testimony you do have on the record, sure. And then I'm going to send you all out in the hall, and you have, 48 hours to fight it out. More like 24 hours, so you may want to stay in town for the next 24 hours. So.
Certainly, no problem. First, what I would like to say is, as an officer and having been in the field for over 18 years, I worked up in Washington County. I worked in the metro area as a probation parole officer. And I can say I can't see that this bill, as proposed, would have changed or increased my ability to work within the field. As I was reflecting back, listening to the testimony, there was a lot of talk about cop, a cop is a cop is a cop, police officers, and training. It actually made me reflect back and question, am I in the same field? When I look back on the origins of probation and parole, essentially we're talking about the responsibility to effect change with the offenders that are sentenced to probation and parole. When you look back on this, I should say there's probably four points that caused me some concern. First is a diversion from the intent and purpose of probation and parole. Second would be fiscal impacts, increased workload and training. Third would be potential legal challenges. And then fourth, local control. When I say diversion from the intent and purpose of probation, as we approach Probation and Community Supervision Officers Week, which is July 17th through the 23rd, I'm reminded of the history establishing the profession. This profession was established by John Augustus,
who is credited to be the father of probation. Essentially, it was a response to a drunkard who was arrested, brought before the Boston police court, and this gentleman, a Boston cobbler, a shoemaker, stepped up and said, give me the opportunity to work with this gentleman. He did not step up and say, I want to be a cop and I want to, what we refer to in the phrase is trail him, nail him, and jail him when he makes a mistake. He was asking the court for the challenge to work with this offender and to take a look and can I make an impact in changing his behavior. Today, probation and parole officers have many tools at their disposal. We do have many of the same tools that police officers carry on the streets. Yes, we do carry handcuffs. We do have firearms. We do have vests. But our training is totally specific and addressed to modifying and promoting change within the offender population. When you talk about the training, same as police officers, that's inaccurate. Our probation and parole academy is 4 weeks. There is a fifth week specific to firearms. That's 40 hours out of there's a total of 5 weeks. 4 weeks specific to probation and parole activities. There's an additional week for firearms. As I understand it, police officers currently attend DPSST for 10 weeks, and I believe that has been expanded and is facing going up to 16 weeks. That is because the functions and activities of a police officer go far beyond the laws and the technicalities that we are training for on probation and parole. I cannot see passage of this bill as currently proposed or the -1 amendments not having an impact on training. I can also not see it not having an impact on workload. Our officers carry many cases, and yes, we are busy. We have sufficient resources at this juncture. While the legislature is currently debating the actual funding of those services, I need to say we have the resources to work with the population under supervision. We are not prepared or set up to deal with a growing population if we were to start imposing our activities and our authority on those that are outside the scope of our supervision. Legal challenges that I can only foresee are those that Senator Ferrioli mentioned. When we enter into the homes, we are entering into the homes under the purposes of probation and parole field activities. We are there to work with the offender, make sure that they're still living there. And again, it's under the direction of the offender reformation process. Entering into the home to work under those processes and then potentially co-mingling a police activity in that environment with those that are not under our control, I can only see raising questions and concerns. Local control, when I bring up the concept of local control, when the state passed the responsibility of community corrections to the counties, that Senate Bill 1145 also created a process called Local Public Safety Coordinating Council. Mm-hmm.
Some of us were here when we created that bill. Now we're regretting it.
Actually, I got to say, I am probably one of the supporters of 1145 in that it does directly create a relationship with its community and best practice around public safety. Procedurally, I see some difficulties in this process in that there was a procedural skip in submitting legislation to address public safety issues in our communities. When I brought this issue up for conversation with our district attorney and our sheriff and our police force and asked them, what do you think about this bill? The response I got was fairly puzzling. None of those partners saw the necessity for it or the importance of having it passed. And they were also challenged, in taking a look at the process through which, why wasn't this raised in a local public safety coordinating council if this was a local public safety issue? Why did we not have the opportunity to speak to it and see the merits of this legislation? I was unable to answer those responses, simply to say it was news to us as well.
And just for the record, I like the concept of 1145. What I was concerned about is the county's not getting their fair share of the dollars in order to pay for it. So that was my concern about 1145. So.
Well, that's good to hear.
Finally, you know, again, not to belabor a point, and I am available to come back to Salem because this is an important issue. I made sure I made the drive today, recognizing that there was some comments of why OACCD was not here when this was processed through the House side. I can say that I did speak with one of my colleagues who was at that process and did speak, and we did share our concerns through our colleague who were represented. But I am available for questions if you would like. But suffice it to say, in a nutshell, first off, I don't believe this bill is necessary. Having worked in the field, I don't see it as improving the efficacy of the challenge that we have before us as probation parole officers. The -2 amendments do address the concerns that were originally raised, specific to the resisting arrest, the hindering, and I believe the service of warrants. I have no objections with the -2 amendments, and I do see those as positive movement. But the specifics towards expanding police officer activities to probation parole officers, that I can say I have some difficulty with, and I can't see that being a benefit to the profession.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Berger. Questions? All right. I'm going to send you all out in the hallway. You got about 48 hours. If you're lucky, you get 3 days. Good luck. Come back with something that everybody can hold hands on. Mr. Powell, Ms. Sky, Mr. Snyder, and Mr. Taylor, if we need to, we'll get you guys on the record. But at this point in time, we're like way behind. So I'm sure I can get you on the record if I need you.
Where is criminal defense lawyers?
They are opposed. All those folks I just named are opposed.
Okay.
So.
Know that.
Madam Chair.
Sarah Shields.
Are some of those folks also invited to the conference in the hall, or are they?
Yeah, they're going to be part of the conference. I think it's going to be a party, probably a 48-hour slumber party. So that we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3379. Let's go to the top of the agenda of our 1 o'clock agenda, folks. And I'll move slowly so you guys can keep up with me. All right.
I don't pretend to keep up with you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, well. Okay. All right. Let's start out with bill introductions and drafting. The chair would move the drafting introduction of the attached language. If anybody wants to see it, I would have to share it. We have not been able to find a priority bill. Your vote in favor of this motion is does not indicate your opposition or support to the substance of the measure, and I can guarantee you that this bill will not delay the end of the session. Any further discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. All right. The chair moves the suspension of the rules for the reconsideration of House Bill 3092. Any objection?
No objections.
Seeing none, the chair opens a work session on House Bill 3092. Colleagues, we sent this out several days ago. There are conflict amendments. Legislative Council is simply asking we adopt the -6 amendments which come before you, which I believe bring the proposal in concordance with other bills, including House Bill 3304. Any questions? Chair would move the -6 amendments to House Bill 3092. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing, seeing none. So ordered. The chair would move the bill as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Senator Atkinson?
Yes.
Senator Bingo?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Aye.
Chair
Brown?
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. I can't remember who was the carrier. Do you have a record of that, Katie? Okay. Let's have whoever carried it carry it before and again. All right. 1072, we'll try and get that back tomorrow.
Chair would open a work session on SJR 9, a proposed amendment to the Oregon Constitution to require annual sessions of the Legislative Assembly. Chair would move SJR 9 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
I can vote for this bill only because I understand the total amount of the workload for legislators will not increase.
That is correct, Senator Ringo. And in fact, I believe it will actually shorten the time that we are here. Chair would move the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing, seeing none. So ordered, Senator Devlin will carry. SJR 24 will bring back that tomorrow afternoon. Chair would open a work session on House Bill 2932-2 amendments. Many of you heard Senator Westland testify. It would allow donated facility to be used as a veterans facility, providing the only veterans facility east of the Cascades in Oregon. The chair would move the dash two amendments to 2932. Any discussion?
Those are added to the original intent.
Correct.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
I have to say that this is a very narrowly tailored bill designed for really a specific parcel.
That is correct.
And I am fine with it, but I will point out that those kind of bills have recently sent certain members of this committee through the roof. And I will point out this is that kind of bill.
Okay. All right.
There's no hole over my chair.
All right.
Paul, there might be.
Any discussion? Any objection to the dash two amendments to House Bill 2932? Seeing none, so ordered, the chair would move the bill to the Senate floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
The other part of the bill is important, too, and I don't want it to get lost. I mean, as much as I support what Senator Westland is doing, I don't want the creation of the Department of Veterans Affairs to get lost in the shuffle.
All right. Any other discussion? So ordered. Do we even hear 3044?
Do you want to designate the carrier?
Yes, yeah, Senator Westland, the carrier.
Okay.
We did 3174. Let's put 3044 on tomorrow's agenda.
Yes, ma'am.
And 3379, they're out in work session. That means we're going to need a few minutes changeover. We need to hear Senate Bill 815. Hopefully we can move forward. And then we've got an informational hearing on some of the issues that parents are facing in the juvenile dependency system. So how much time do you guys need? 2 minutes. Can you guys sit still for 2 minutes? Let me see if I can help you.
Yeah, sure.
Madam Chair, we're in recess. We're adjourned.
No. Okay.